Pesticides.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this September 15th meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Welcome to all of you who are here. We have a really packed agenda, a lot of interesting topics, and really excited to have so many people here to be part of it. We have some housekeeping before we begin, but in the meantime, I'd like to call up Peter Doherty and Lena Tucker. Why don't you make your way up, and Beth Petrino, our administrator, will tell us some exciting news about our new recording system.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and members of the audience, just a couple notes. We have a new recording system for the hearing rooms now, and where the blue light on the desk over there used to flash when the system was on pause, it won't do that anymore. So when the blue light is on, the recording system is operating. When it's off, it's not. Just a heads up so everybody knows when the recording is taking place. And then second thing is background briefs, which are documents that the committee services staff prepares on a variety of topics, have just been updated. We have a sample for each of the members up here, but they're also on the website, so if anybody needs assistance finding them, I'd be happy to help. And then, Mr. Chair, also just a note that Aaron Everett, the state forester in Washington, is on the line.
Great. Thank you, Beth. And let me just say that our new recording system now allows us to have our meetings archived, not just in an audio manner, but video as well. And that's really great because that'll allow people after the fact to see the different graphs and charts and things that are projected up. It's a really great system, very easy to use. So I'd encourage you to use it. So our first two issues that we're going to be covering today are really follow-ups of the topic that we worked on in our May meeting, interim meeting, which was has to do with aerial spraying and was provoked by the incidents that happened in Curry County last year. One of the things that we heard, very clearly from constituents was a desire for a better notification for people in the field about what kind of forestry operations were happening in their sphere. The Department of Forestry is doing some interesting work in this area, and we're going to hear about that first of all, and then we will hear from Washington, get a sense of how they do things there, and maybe have a few minutes for some cross-state comparison and recommendation. Okay, so we'll start out with Peter. Do you want to kick it off? Welcome to the committee, Peter.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dambrough, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Doherty, and I serve as a Private Forest Division Chief for the Oregon Department of Forestry. With me is Lena Tucker, Deputy Division Chief for our division, and we're here today to provide an overview of the Oregon Forest Practice Act electronic notification system. The electronic notification system emerged from 2011 legislative direction to seek cost savings and efficiencies in the administration of the Forest Practice Act. In response, we reviewed and updated our business processes because it makes no sense to computerize a bad business process. We reached out to internal and external stakeholders and completed a business case for the electronic notification system in 2012 and 2013. We contracted with the Timmons Group to begin developing the system. The phase one release was started in August of 2013 and completed in May of this year. We used agile development, which is an iterative approach to building a computer system. We built individual components over a two-week period, and then we followed up with testing for 2 to 4 weeks. We saw constant progress, stayed involved, and it helps ensure we get what we want. And I'll turn it over to Lena now to go into the system design.
Thanks, Peter. Lena?
Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lena Tucker, and I serve as the Deputy Chief for the Oregon Department of Forestry Private Forest Division. Why notify? Well, by law, an operator, a landowner, a timber owner must notify the state forester where an operation will be located and what type of activities will be conducted. The Department of Forestry uses this information to monitor forestry operations and enforce the forest practices laws to protect natural resources and the environment. The initial system development for e-notification focused on this priority direction to administer the Forest Practices Act more efficiently. That meant addressing the core purposes of notification, ensuring that people who planned an operation in the woods could notify us, get a permit to operate power-driven machinery, and notify the Department of Revenue of their intent to harvest timber. We also wanted a system that would allow our foresters and our office specialists to receive and review the information in a timely manner. Today, we have a paper process, and it is time-consuming. It has many redundancies, it's prone to error, and it is inefficient. The information that is submitted on paper forms has to be manually entered into ODF databases, and the maps of the unit boundaries have to be redigitized into our geographic information system programs. This manual process often causes delays in response to our timber owners and our operators when they file notifications, and to the public who can subscribe to receive copies of notifications. With e-notification, we get efficiency. It means that our foresters can spend more time in the woods and with better information, working with landowners and the operators. In planning this system, we consulted with many potential users. Those users provided us with their requirements, what they wanted the system today to do, or what we call user stories. How do they want to receive those services? So by July of 2013, we accumulated 170 user stories. In order to focus on the foundation of the system, which basically, again, we need to allow a user to notify and for ODF to receive that information and process it, we prioritized 44 user stories for the first release. Release 2 development is adding an additional 27 user stories for the web-based notification system and 11 stories for the mobile application that our foresters will use to conduct industrial fire inspections, to conduct forest practices inspections in the field. We're also creating the ability to renew a notification from 1 year into the next. Our current backlog, which is our list, includes an additional 200 user stories that we plan to complete as funding will allow. As you can imagine, during our rollout and our training of the system, we've received quite a few more user stories or user requirements of what they would like the system to accomplish. At the initial registration, everyone must register, and they complete their contact information just once. The system stores this, and it allows the customer to focus on creating their notification in subsequent visits to the site. The map opens to the state of Oregon, and the search tool allows the user to locate their operation area by township and range, street address, or geographic place names. You can use a topo map or an aerial photo or street view to further define where your operation is located. Mapping tools are very simple to use. A click of the mouse is all that is needed to draw your operation area. Those with GIS programs can easily cut and paste their shape file of their units and put them into the program. After the operation areas are mapped, the system prompts the user to specify the types of activities that will be conducted, along with estimated start and end dates, and the methods by which they will accomplish an activity. And when the user completes entry of where the operation is located and what activities will occur, they are able to review a summary and go through and make sure everything is complete before they submit. Upon submission, all parties, the operators, the landowners, and the timber owners, to that notification instantly receive a confirmation email informing them that they are indeed a party to this notification, and there is a link that takes them right to that summary page. If all parties are registered users in the system, they can also see copies of the notification as well as messages from their stewardship foresters on their dashboard or their homepage. We have a few kind of commonly asked questions about e-notification, and one of them is, will there be a registration screening process or a user fee to control access? And right now, all you need is a valid email address. No fees are being considered at this time. How will the non-internet user notify? Currently, our field offices are setting up computer kiosks at their front lobby, and our office staff are being trained to help them walk through the process of doing electronic notifications. The other question that comes up is, will there be a public portal to request information on forest operations? In planning the system, we consulted with potential users, including the many people who currently subscribe. Subscribers include individuals interested in forestry practices in their area, water districts, log buyers, consulting foresters, local and state government agencies, and federal agencies. We had hoped to include an automated subscription process in the current iteration, but we did not have the resources for this development at this time. Funds to automate and streamline the subscription process are included in our 2015-2017 budget request. Currently, our subscription process will remain the same, and the subscribers will continue to receive the same level of service that they receive today.
Thank you. Since June of 2013, we've been conducting internal and external user training, and release one of the e-notification system is on track for go live on October 1. Thank you, and we'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay, I just have a couple of quick questions. Lena, opening the portal up to the public would require additional investments. How much do you calculate that to be, estimate that to be?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. Currently, the entire process is open to the public. The only things that the public can do on it now is, if they're a timber owner or a landowner or an operator, is to notify the state forester of their operation, apply for a permit to operate power-driven machinery, and notify the Department of Revenue. Like I said, we have approximately 200 stories in our backlog of more projects to complete, and we've put in a request for our 2015-27 budget to accomplish those.
Mm-hmm. So how much would it cost? I mean, are we looking at a lot of money that it would require to, you know, let me be clear. I mean, okay. I think the interest mm-hmm. here is that, and as you know, it's the spraying issue that, you know, that, mm-hmm. that provoked the interest of the committee. So if people who live in an area want easy notification that a spray is coming, how much will it take to get that?
Thank you, Senator Dembrough. For the budget request, we basically put together two large projects, and one of those is automating the subscription project, and the other is to complete a reporting process and as well as some additional workflow improvements. Both of those I've forecasted out to be right around $500,000 for each development package, so I've separated both of those into separate functions.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes. Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you, Lena. You had mentioned in your presentation that people could come into the field office.
Yes.
Are there many out there? Are they readily available in all the cities, or is it a long travel to get to them?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson. We have field offices located around the state. We have about 12 district offices and a few subunit offices. And so I believe the location of these offices are in the normal areas that people travel and do business. Today, most people come into the office to submit their paper notification form. Again, if folks have internet access at home, they can access the system at home and complete their notification online.
Yes, Senator Hansel.
Just a quick question. Is there a minimum threshold of when you have to report an activity? For example, I would think a chainsaw is a power tool, and if you're going to go in and cut up some firewood on a tree that blew over, do you need to report on that, get permission to do that?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, Senator Hansel. The situation that you're describing sounds more like the application for a permit to operate power-driven machinery, which is required through our fire protection laws. The notification system to notify the state forest of the intent to conduct a forestry operation is required for commercial operations, not the personal use of your chainsaw at home.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we hear from Mr. Everett from State of Washington. Mr. Everett, welcome. Thank you very much for giving us your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Everett. I'm the state forester with Washington State Department of Natural Resources. Can I do an audio check and make sure you can hear me okay?
You sound great.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks for the invitation. I apologize for not being able to join you in person today, but I'm glad to share with you the department's forest practices application review system, or affectionately known as FPARS. We didn't have a vegetation-related acronym, evidently, for the folks who conceived this system. But FPARS is an online enrollment-based system of notification, submittal, and review of forest practices documents. And the way it works is that all users who want to use the full functionality of FPARS need to create a profile. And the profile allows them to obtain access to a secure website, and that's for a couple of different reasons, but mostly users who get sort of that next tier close to the sort of corporate operating systems of the state need to have a secure access website. Creating that profile allows them to receive automated email notices according to parameters that they define. And so examples of parameters that they might define are, when do they want to know if an application's been submitted, or do they want to know if an application's been approved, or whether there are changes to an application, the particular types of applications they want to know about, such as pesticide spray, for example, different types of practices. There's an online series of choices that the user gets to sort of define a geographic area or a type of practice or a type of decision that they're interested in, as well as sort of screens and triggers that exist in our rules for stages of additional environmental review. The principal users of FPARS I would sort of characterize as applicants, agencies, tribes, and sort of professional reviewers. It's not a very publicly oriented sort of information system. It takes a little bit of work for people to get access to it, but once they do, as I said, they can sort of define what they're interested in and what they want to hear about. Applicants can submit their applications online through the system, and as well as creating an online map to go along with their application of the activities that are proposed, or they can, of course, submit sort of raw GIS files to the department. We still have an option for, and it's one that many applicants avail themselves of, for people to submit hard copy applications, which are often handwritten with hand check marks and application boxes and a hand-drawn map, which, as Peter and Lena mentioned, still requires a lot of hand data entry and digitization by office staff. It's a little bit labor-intensive, but it's an accommodation for folks who are less technologically savvy. If people don't want to create a profile and obtain secure access to the website, we have an option that's somewhat newly created, where more review-oriented users can simply search by a geographic area or an application number without creating a profile, but they don't get the added functions of automated notices in email when an application's been submitted or when a decision's been made on an application. We also have, as I alluded to before, a sort of an online mapping and viewing tool that has, as I characterize, as basic functionality. It enables an applicant to create a digital map to go along with their application. It also enables reviewers to go in and look at the location of applications. But it's pretty basic. It shows roads and streams and a little bit of resource information. We do allow and regularly update users who have GIS capability to download pretty well everything that the department uses to review applications in the office. From our website, those data are updated by DNR weekly, and so GIS layers for sort of the more complicated resource information or specific map layers for individual forest practice applications are all available to anyone who has we don't put those currently on the mapping tool site simply because of the size constraints in hosting it on a sort of arcane version of technology. And that rounds out the basic functionality of our system. I think to touch on an issue that's been asked already, we have an application system generally, and so we receive a proposal, we evaluate it within a specified time frame and make a decision about whether to disapprove, approve, or condition the application. And so thereafter, the applications are good for a three-year time period, and it's a bit in contrast to a more notification-oriented system, although we do get quite a number of notification type of applications as well. So I guess maybe a contrast between the two states there is that ours, or many of ours, are applications that have a three-year shelf life. And so a notice of immediate commencement of operations is something that our system doesn't accommodate. And that's principally the reason for it, is that we have a longer window in which on-the-ground operations can commence. Those are the broad strokes. I had figured that we would want to reserve an adequate amount of time for questions and discussions, and I'm happy to answer those at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Everett. That's great. Questions? Not. I have one. So interest in Washington in enhancing your, public access, short-term notification kind of capacity?
I'm looking at modernizing this whole system. It's one that I think has caused us and the public and reviewers a fair amount of frustration. It was built during a period of time when agencies had a little more resource and could afford to sort of custom build software applications for themselves, and there wasn't a lot available commercially either. And consequently, it's not a very nimble system. So changes to it take a lot of time and resource for something that's relatively simple to do. And I would consider, notification functions along with a whole host of others to be within the scope of potential updates to the system in the near future.
Thank you. So back to our Oregon people then. The capacity of reviewers to just, go in and search on an area and be able to get information, for their area, is that something that makes sense to the department? Is it something the department is thinking about? Could you speak to that?
Yes, Chair Dembro. So currently we have a basic search tool within the system. It was designed up front to help the landowner, the timber owner, the operator quickly access and find their notification. However, this is available for any registered user to the system. So this is kind of the groundwork, per se, for moving forward with an automated subscription system. This basic search tool that we have today does not meet our statutorily required obligation to make sure that subscribers receive a copy of the notification or the written plan within 6 working days. Again, the search tool only shows the notifications that are in the system and the information on the summary page. However, it is a first start to getting to a more automated, streamlined system.
Thank you. Representative Hovey. Welcome.
Thank you. Will you allow me to ask a question here? I appreciate it.
Ask it, and then I'll decide if it can be answered.
So it sounds like the policy in place in Oregon and Washington doesn't permit a neighbor or somebody who's living close by to a forestry operation, and specifically a pesticide application, to be notified of that operation that could be coming to their neighborhood.
Senator Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, and Representative Hovey, no, we currently, if you want to sign up to be notified for a given geographic area, you are sent any notification for whatever activities you specify in your area within 6 days of when we receive that notification. So there's a 15-day waiting period, the concern about aerial applications. We don't waive that. So currently we provide that information on a subscription basis, which was, that process was started back in 1983 for people that were interested in statutory written plans. We also provide all the information in our notification system free of charge on a monthly basis as a searchable access database. And we have about 30 folks or companies that currently receive that. So on a monthly basis, we provide all notifications in the state of Oregon information in a searchable database to parties who are interested.
Yes.
So that means a neighbor could feasibly sign up and get those notifications. I'd be curious if that's also true in Washington.
Mr. Everett?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is also true in Washington. The design of our application review system enables a user to specify geography, their neighborhood, and to receive applications or receive notice of applications that involve pesticide applications, both in terms of when the application is received and when the decision is made on the application. And furthermore, our rules require that the actual area of the spray, that the spray is going to take place, is physically posted within 5 days of when the application or when the spray is intended to take place.
Mm-hmm. And to both of you, what happens in the case where, you know, there's a scheduled operation and then because of weather conditions it's postponed? Are you notified of that? And is that something that gets posted or sent out as well? Or just the initial, you know, indication that's going to happen within this time frame, is that all that the public has access to?
Senator Denbrough, Vice Chair Olson, the public's given access to the initial notification, which has, as Lena mentioned, an estimated start and stop date for the operation. So there's not a precise date for when the operation will occur, because that's often, as you mentioned, due to weather or scheduling events when you're doing multiple operations.
How difficult would it be from your perspective to make those notifications more real time? I mean, if a change needs to be made where that could happen and it would be sent out, posted, whatever, would that be very difficult from your perspective, sort of difficult, doable?
Senator Denbrough, Vice Chair Olson, it's hard to give an estimate since that isn't the current policy in the state, and we haven't done a lot of work on what it would take. In a sense, it would require an amended notification, and so we would have to amend the notification or create a new process for notifying more specifically about a particular start or stop date for an operation.
Yes, Senator Roblin, welcome.
Thank you very much. You know, we're hitting forestry pretty hard on this, but what percentage of aerial applications are done by forestry as opposed to other opportunities to do that in the state? You know, any idea?
Senator Denbrough, Senator Roblin, no, I do not know the number of aerial pesticide applications in other than forestry, right. But I do have about 2% of private forest lands in the state of Oregon receive a chemical application per year. That's roughly around 220,000 acres per year receive some form of chemical application. Not all of them are aerial. I don't have the breakdown by aerial.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you so much for making this presentation. I want to compliment you on putting together the FERN system, you know, as an effective, my impression is that on a fairly modest budget, you've developed a really helpful process that's going to streamline the ability of people in the forestry community to enter and receive information. So I want to first thank you for that what seems to be really effective, exciting work, and then ask a follow-up question related to the policy option package you describe, that potentially with some additional resource would enable you to make the Fern system even more publicly accessible and searchable by interested individuals in addition to applicators or landowners. Is the work that we're talking about now so that you could find out within existing parameters when an application is going to occur on nearby land a feature that would be built into the new system if the policy option package is funded?
Senator Denbrough, Representative Leininger, yes, we envision this to happen. Some of the user stories is I would like to be able to sign up and do my subscription electronically. I would like to receive notification via email. Now, again, as Lena mentioned, our subscriber database is quite diverse. We have about 20 to 25 individuals that subscribe out of about 115 subscribers. A majority of our subscribers are cities, counties, there's about 66 city and county agencies that subscribe. And we'd need to also look at their user stories. But yes, we envision being able to automate our current subscription system with the policy option package.
And that would be at no cost, I'm sorry, may I ask?
Yes.
That would be at no cost to the community members who are seeking that information, as I understand it?
Currently, Senator Denbrough, Representative Leininger, currently the reason that we do have an administrative fee is our process is paper-based, and our office specialist has to print and copy and snail mail these notifications to our subscriber groups. If we automate the system, then everything, in theory, can be processed automatically via email, or the subscriber group could have a dashboard or a homepage like our timber owners, landowners, and operators, where they can access and see the notification information. So at that point, there doesn't make sense to have an administrative charge if we're not processing paper or spending the office specialist time putting those materials together.
Thank you, Lena. That's great news. Senator Bates, you had a question?
Yeah, I'm probably missing the point here, so I probably shouldn't ask the question. You're talking about e-notification. I appreciate that. And notifying people when sprayings occur near them. But it seems to me the real problem is that I would expect the vast majority of people who are spraying are doing it in a careful and thoughtful way. They're not harming their neighbors. They're doing a good job. But you can have somebody out there who is an outlier. And all of a sudden we start thinking about changing the whole system to one outlier. And when I read through the materials, this is the question I'm actually getting to, it appears that the Department of Forestry has no way of just going in on a random basis and spot checking or checking how it's being applied, and when it's being applied. You don't have that authority to do that from what I saw here, or not the resources to do it anyway. The Curry County issue really highlights all that. So my question is, what is your role? What do you really want to do? Where do you see yourself going as an agency in this really pretty important issue to some people? You want to be fair to the timber producers. At the same time, you need to be able to protect the public, and it looks to me like, if I'm reading this right, you haven't got the tools for that. E-notification is great, but if someone's going to go ahead and spray on a certain date and he or she doesn't do it properly, got notified, but it didn't matter. Okay. So my question is, do you need more tools? Do you need change in law? Do you need change in administrative rules so you can go in and routinely check all this?
Always a dangerous question to ask an agency person, Senator. Yes, Peter? Senator, would you like some more money?
Senator Denbrough, Senator Bates, yes, I would always have. In response, Senator Denbrough, Senator Bates, we do regularly inspect operations. We often do not go on site during a chemical spray operation because that is not an effective evaluation of whether the chemical stayed on site. But we do follow-up investigations to look for off-site drift, which is pretty obvious with herbicides in a vegetative environment. And so we see damage for vegetations. We are also now doing an annual compliance audit. This first 2 years on which we're conducting it, we're focusing on harvest units, roads, and water quality. So we don't have the pesticide rules in that compliance audit. But over time, we'll expand that compliance audit to check all operations. So we currently do have the authority to go in and inspect operations either when they're active or shortly thereafter to ensure that the forest practice rules were followed.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, both of you. Mr. Everett, again, thank you very much for giving us your time. Really appreciate your perspective. Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to move on now to the second item, which is a related one, and that is, Katie, if you can make your way up. Colleagues, you'll remember at our meeting in May, there was very strong a desire expressed by members up here to see a more coordinated emergency response to the to when things go wrong. And the various agencies involved were asked to come up with a plan for coordinated emergency response when we have a problem with pesticide application. And the agencies have been working on this issue for the last few months, with the Department of Agriculture being in the lead role for it, and are working towards creating a set of standard operating procedures. And Katie, you're going to let us know where you all are on this and what the timeline is for its completion.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good afternoon. Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. So today what I wanted to do was review where we're currently at with the Curry County pesticide incident and enforcement actions, give an overview of the Pesticide Analytical Response Center and what that is, and then talk about, as you had mentioned, Mr. Chair, the PARC initiatives to better coordinate Oregon's response to pesticide incidents. As a reminder, not quite a year ago, we had a pesticide incident in Curry County. It was last October where we had an aerial application near Gold Beach. We immediately began receiving outreach from local residents who had concerns about both human and animal health exposure to pesticides, and we're experiencing health-related results related to that. We began an investigation at that point in time into this case, and it was very much a multi-agency effort, including our Department of Agriculture, that should be the Forestry Department, Health Authority, and EPA. I think you've heard me mention before that this was an incredibly complex investigation for us, one of the most complex that we've had in my tenure as director. It was a unique case from many aspects, but as you will see, we believe we have some lessons learned from this case, and we can make improvements both from a Department of Agriculture perspective as well as from a multi-agency coordinating response moving forward. In April, we released the results of our investigation into this case, and we found three violations from the incident. First of all, the operator provided false and misleading information to the agency in the course of our investigation. This is a violation of state statute, and for us in the Department of Agriculture, and I would say for my sister agencies as well that do regulatory work, this is a very serious violation. A lot of the regulatory work that we do in state government relies on getting accurate information from those that we regulate, and that's a real core underpinning in our regulatory work. That did not happen in this case, and that for us is a very serious violation.
In addition, a second very serious violation, we did find pesticide residues from this application off of the application site, and those residues were found in rural residential neighborhood. And then third, we had a violation where the applicator used one of the products in the application over the maximum labeled rate allowed for that product. Since your last meeting in May, we have completed our enforcement actions. And I want to back up just a minute. So you have the three counts here, the providing false and misleading information, the finding of the pesticide residue off the application rate or site, and then using the product over the maximum rate. We were coordinating with EPA throughout the course of this investigation and also worked with them once we had found these violations. The providing false and misleading information is a violation of state statute, so the Department of Agriculture took the lead on the enforcement action with that violation. The other two violations are violations of FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act, and EPA chose to move forward on the enforcement actions for those two counts. And so moving forward, we have gone ahead on the count of providing false and misleading information and have assessed a civil penalty in the amount of $10,000 to the operator and to the applicator, as well as a one-year license revocation for both the operator and the applicator. The Department of Forestry also moved forward on Forest Practices Act administrative violations, and then EPA under FIFRA is moving forward on the enforcement actions for the two pesticide residue and maximum label violation. We have issued our enforcement actions. The operator is appealing those actions, and so we are currently in the administrative procedures process for our enforcement part of that. The EPA process is also underway. That is a confidential process until there's a final agreement or settlement in that case, and so that is underway, and we're not absolutely certain what the EPA enforcement actions are at this point in time. I'm going to stop there because I'm going to move next to a discussion about PARC and see if there's any questions about the Curry County case, the violations, or the enforcement actions that are underway.
Senator Hensel.
Just a quick question, Director. When was the penalty levied? When did the operator receive the notification of the penalty?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hensel, we issued our civil penalty and license revocation about August 6th, I believe.
Thanks. I don't know if you might not have this information, but is there any action? I should know this. Is there any action taken against the state or the agencies by some of the property owners down there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Haas, there has been a suit filed challenging the Right to Farm, Right to Forest Act associated with, and they're linking it to this case. So that would be a suit challenging the constitutionality of those statutes. There's no action that I'm aware of against any agencies at this point in time.
Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you. This is kind of a two-part question. The first part is, are there allowances for the exact site, you know, like residue, is it 2 feet over or 3 feet over the property line? And the second part of that question would be, how far over the lines or over the borders were these residues found?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the location of the residences where the products were found was quite a distance from the application site. So the helicopter, which was the means of the aerial application, loaded on one ridge, loaded their load, and then flew over the residences up over another ridge and down into an area where they applied the pesticide. So, as I said, it was quite a distance from the actual application site to the residence. I think the challenge in this case is trying to figure out how that pesticide ended up in the rural residential neighborhood. We don't believe it was a case of drift from the actual application site because of the nature of the geography. It's still a question mark how we found that material in the neighborhood.
And the other part of that question is, are there allowances for the boundaries if they are applying to a specific area? Is there an allowance that with wind drift or whatever the residue can go 12 yards over the property line, or is there any allowance in that manner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, no, there's not.
Okay. Thank you.
Katie, the applicator, so this was a helicopter application, so presumably the applicator is also governed by the FAA, right? Mm-hmm. And so is the FAA getting involved in this process? Are they looking at a potential license revocation?
Mr. Chairman, we submitted information to the FAA here in Oregon, and apparently what we have found out is he is, this operator is, I'm not an expert on the FAA, I apologize, I know Senator Johnson is. My understanding is he falls under either the license or the area from a California FAA office. We have not, and apparently the Oregon office forwarded that information to the California office. We have not received information back from them to know if they're taking any action or not.
Thank you. Yes, Sir Polvey.
Thank you. Katie, thank you for your report. I'm curious, is the first violation that ODA took action on, revocating the license for 1 year, is that the maximum amount of time that ODA has authority to impose that penalty? Could they have revoked the license forever, for example?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, there's no limits in statutes or guidance in statutes in terms of license revocation. This is a fairly unusual action for the department to take. We have had, I would say in the last year or so, a couple of other cases where we've had license revocations, but those have been a much shorter revocation, and it's required, we've required retesting, documentation of plans from the applicator or operator to make sure they don't have violations again, and also submitting required training materials from the operator in terms of training their applicators, again, to understand pesticide law. Those revocations have gone, I think, no more than 2 weeks. This enforcement action here, revoking a license for a year, is by far the longest license revocation we've imposed during my tenure as director.
But you could have revoked it for 5 years, potentially.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, yes. I think in discussions with the Department of Justice and other cases they've had, not pesticide-related cases, but other license revocation cases, there's a pretty high bar, especially when they're appealed through the administrative process, in terms of balancing the violation with the severity of the penalty, or in this case, the license revocation. And after consultation with the Department of Justice, we felt this was the right balance given the violation.
Okay, one last, and then we'll have to move on.
Thank you. So I'm also curious about the oversight of spray applications in general, and how does the department know whether the information they're getting about a spray application is accurate? I mean, how much oversight does the agency actually have over that information? Are they reviewing that information on spray applications, or does it just happen that they review it when there's an incident?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, we have the ability to request records when we're conducting an investigation. Other than that, the department doesn't on a routine basis receive spray records from applicators. It's purely in the course of an investigation when we go out and request those records. And in this case, I think what triggered our initial suspicion that the record was not accurate was the product that was claimed to be used in the case of this treatment and the knowledge and expertise that our investigators have that doesn't match up with the kind of normal products that we see used in the case. And at that point in time, we started digging deeper and having conversations with the applicator and operator that obviously ultimately led to the fact that they had submitted misleading information.
Thank you.
One quick question. Because the spray was so far away from the intended area, was there any examination of the aircraft for mechanical malfunction?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, yes, we did do that. It was, if my memory serves me correct, a couple of months after the application, and so it wasn't immediately at that time. But the aircraft was inspected, and there was nothing there that we could determine would have led to a faulty equipment.
Okay, thanks. Katie, why don't you move on with the going forward?
So, Mr. Chair, there exists in the state an entity called the Pesticide Analytical Response Center. It was created by executive order in the 70s and then codified in statute in the 90s. And the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, or PARC, is made up of the 8 state agencies that you see listed here, as well as a public member that serves on PARC. And this investigation was an investigation that was reviewed and watched by PARC, I guess is a good way to describe what happened. The actual statutory requirements of PARC are listed here. It is an interagency coordination team made up of the agencies that you saw listed. And the responsibility really is to mobilize state agencies with responsibilities in pesticide incidents and response. And these could be incidences dealing with human health, animal health, or environmental issues. The functions by statute, as you can see, establish procedures for carrying out responsibilities, identify trends, patterns, and problems, report out on pesticide incidents, make recommendations to improve pesticide regulatory system. I think it's really important to note that PARC is in and of itself is not an investigative entity, and it does not have enforcement actions, but really coordinates what these member agencies do. So as an example, the Department of Agriculture, we license and regulate the use of pesticides in the state. Forestry is responsible for carrying out the Forest Practices Act. Department of Environmental Quality would have drinking water fall under their purview. Or OSHA has pesticide emphasis programs related to worker safety issues. Health Authority obviously deals with pesticide-related illnesses, as does the Poison Control Center. So each of these agencies have their statutory responsibilities, and the role of PARC, as it was envisioned, was to have these agencies get together and make sure they're talking to each other, sharing information. Are there some trends that we see going on? Do we seem to have a number of cases of, as an example, which we do, a lot of problems come from homeowner use of bug bombs. And so if we see that, are there some education and outreach things we can put in place to ensure that we don't have problems with these issues? So that really is the role of PARC. With the Curry County case, as I had mentioned earlier, clearly there are lessons that we learned from this case and some things that are going to drive changes in how PARC works. Number one, we definitely saw in hindsight that we needed improved PARC board coordination and communication during the pesticide incident response. Secondly, clearly we needed improved communication and outreach during the pesticide incident with the affected community. And I think in hindsight, if there was anything that I would say looking back, when we started getting those false and misleading records, we quit communicating with the community. And our focus at that point in time was really concerned with making sure we were conducting an investigation that would hold up to a legal challenge. However, when we stopped communicating with the community, they became very concerned about what was going on. They felt that information was being misheld from them. They were concerned about their health issues and not able to get the answers that they needed. And so that caused a lot of concern with the community. And I know going forward from this point on. That is something that we will share information, even if it's false and misleading, and do the best we can to keep affected individuals informed in terms of the course of an investigation. I do want to stress here, I think there has been some criticism about the length of the investigation. Some people felt that it seemed to be needlessly long. I can tell you that this six-month investigation, in the world of the work that we do in complex pesticide investigations, that's actually a fairly rapid investigation. So I wouldn't say that the length of the investigation was the problem. It really was the communication or lack of communication throughout the course of the investigation and the fact that residents were concerned about health. And then finally, the third lesson would be the need to basically create PARC standard operating procedures. So PARC kind of evolved over time, and it was much more, I would say, an informal kind of working environment. PARC gets together, the board meets once every 2 months, and it's an information sharing kind of entity. We do have a biennial report or an annual report that comes out from PARC. But given the complexity of this case and the concern about how these agencies work together, we felt that we needed to become much more formalized in terms of the way that PARC operates. And so we have started now developing these standard operating procedures. I would be honest with you in saying that in May, when we were in front of you, we thought we could have this work completed by September. As we started developing the procedures, it's become clear to us that it's going to take longer, and so unfortunately those are not complete. But I can share with you a little bit about what we're doing and how this might look when it's completed. I think it's important to note that the PARC coordinator is a single point of contact for the public. So if the public has concerns about a pesticide incident, they can contact PARC, and PARC can connect them to the right entity given the nature of the incident. But if PARC is working correctly, those individuals could also be calling Poison Control Center and also get funneled into the PARC process. So we wouldn't limit the public's content to PARC only, but if that's the place they call, there should be a seamless coordination out to the agencies that need to be connected. Or if that initial contact goes into an agency, again, a seamless effort of communication amongst the agencies that should be involved.
So, Katie, just to clarify that, because this is, I think, where we heard a lot of complaint, mm-hmm. was in the public health side of it. So if a physician, for example, were to suspect that a patient had been exposed to a pesticide, then he or she could contact the Poison Center, Control mm-hmm. Center, and that would kick off the PARC process.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct, yes. Or the health authority directly, or the PARC coordinator. All of those things would trigger the process and that coordinated response effort.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair.
Katie, thank you very much. When you say you communicate with the community, what do you tell them, basically? That you're investigating now and you go into further detail, or is it just we're in the process right now to determine what happened and how it happened and why it happened?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, in the case of the Curry County incident, when we got the initial record, we shared with the community what the pesticide was that at least was stated on that record in terms of being applied. When we realized that was probably a false record, at that point in time, we did not share with the community what we were getting in terms of updated records or the laboratory results from the samples that were taken in the residential neighborhood. From here on out, we will share that information as we get it. So in the Curry County case, if there's an amended record, we will share with the community what the products were on that amended record. When there are laboratory results, we will be sharing that information of those lab results with the community as well, even before the investigation is complete. There was another procedural thing that happened in this case. We believed, and it was the department's policy, to not share laboratory results until the investigation was complete. There was a request from the Attorney General challenging the confidentiality of that information. The Attorney General ruled that that did not qualify as being confidential under the public records request. So the other piece of that is, because of the Attorney General's ruling, that information is public record when we receive it as well.
Just to follow up, I realize, you know, there are some complications with this particular situation in Curry County, but, you know, if imagine a situation which, you know, you didn't have falsified records, there was, you know, a misapplication that you knew about. How would you or whoever, the park director, park coordinator, get the word out to the community so that, I mean, I think that's probably what people would want to see happen, so that they would be put on notice to, you know, look out for symptoms?
Mr. Chair, that will be spelled out clearly in the park standard operating procedures. The second piece of that is, well, maybe if I could put a pause on that question, because I think that might be answered here in the next couple of slides, and then we can come back to it if that isn't clear for you.
Yeah, and we're probably going to have to wrap up this segment.
Yes, I think we're close. So the intent in terms of the communication outreach piece, as I've mentioned, is to provide more information during the course of the investigation, make sure local officials in the community also know what's going on, because clearly residents contact their local officials as well. Not only do we want to create these standard operating procedures, and what I handed out to you was the kind of the draft table of contents, so you can see kind of the complexity of what we're looking at. We're expecting that standard operating procedure document to be nearly 50 pages long. And so what we'd like to do is create a shorter citizens roadmap to pesticide incidents in Oregon that would be a little more consumer-friendly, if you will, and wouldn't need the technical detail that we as agencies need to make sure we have in coordinating with each other. So I would hope that that citizens roadmap would also outline, you know, what kind of information they have access to and when. And then also continue to explore and implement whatever additional communication tools we could take advantage of to share that information in a timely manner. As you can see from the table of contents, I won't go through it in detail. You know, we've got agencies that are doing their work, making sure we understand how they're referring information, what triggers a referral and follow-up action, how the agencies are coordinating and making sure we're not having holes in that effort. Clearly, requests from healthcare providers for pesticide use information and how to provide medical treatment is very, very important. And I can tell you that the health authority is developing information to get out to the medical community to make sure they know what they have access to, when they should be reporting, and clarify that information. And obviously referrals to and from park to member agencies, which I've already spoken to. So you've got the table of contents. You also have another one-pager that speaks a little bit more as well to coordinating pesticide incidents in Oregon and a little more detail on what agencies do in those situations. So in summary, we have the latest in terms of the Curry County enforcement actions that have been issued and at least ours that's under appeal. Our goal is to have our standard operating procedures completed by the end of the year. And then I'm available to answer any other questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Katie. Questions? Yes, Representative Leininger.
I really appreciate that you're looking at communications opportunities, because it sounds like access to information was one of the key pieces of concern in this situation. We heard from ODF just now about this pretty excellent database website that they've put together that they're looking to have become publicly accessible. How would you feel about the idea of one of the pieces of information on that database that's publicly accessible being information about what was applied to a given area of land within some set period of time after the application is made, so that if in fact people 500 feet away, 2 miles away, 3 miles away feel concerned that they've been affected, they will at least know what the chemicals were that were recently applied, and the whole public would have access to it, not necessarily just through the police or through the health authority or through your office, but people could simply go online and take a quick look.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, is your question limited only to forestry applications, or are you
just
talking about
only
all
to aerial spraying
aerial
and forestry?
Spraying. So forestry is different than agriculture.
Right.
And forestry has different notification requirements under
right.
the Forest Practices Act than other agricultural operations. General agricultural spraying does not require notification under current law.
So this is, my question was actually not about, it was about after the fact information, which I understand now is kept by the applicator from aerial sprays, but evidently not easy to access at times when that's useful. And my question was, does it sound reasonable to put that onto a website that would be publicly accessible in exactly that kind of situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, so the state currently does not receive application records unless we're conducting an investigation. So we can't basically make that information public. I think the question becomes, in the course of an investigation, what is a good communication tool for the information that we do have? And I think I'm going to go back to the premise that our Curry County incident was a very unique incident, pretty unusual. I'm hoping, knock on wood, that we don't have another incident like this in the future. So I think some of the challenges we have is the incidents that we have are different. And I think trying to figure out in the differences of those cases, what is the best way to communicate and share that information? And I think we're going to have to spend some time thinking about that and looking about whether there are similarities in cases that warrant a good communication mechanism and what that might be. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Katie. Colleagues, you know, obviously this is an issue we're going to keep our eye on. We'll be probably coming back to some part of it in our December committee days, maybe zero in a little more on the health communication aspect of it. And then have a look at the SOPs when they're, you know, when they're created, and would really appreciate your feedback on them once we have them. For those of you who've come from the area to visit, I hope this was information useful to you. This will be an issue that we will continue to be following. If there is any legislation around these issues, then there'll be public hearings where you'll have an opportunity to testify. But, you know, the purpose of today's meeting is to give us a status report, let us know how things are proceeding, and what the next step should be. So, Katie, thank you for a very clear presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, I'm going to close that portion of the hearing, and we will move closer to home for me, to Multnomah County, and ask Dick Springer to come up, please, and talk to us about Sturgeon Lake. Dick, once again, your talent for clearing a hall, it's amazing.
Free ice cream cones. Stay.
Forgot the popcorn. Learned a long time ago not to take it personally.
Senator, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, honorable members. My name is Dick Springer, and appreciate very much the opportunity to appear before you this afternoon, share a little information about a very important restoration project in the Columbia River on Sabe Island to save Sturgeon Lake. And in just a few minutes, or actually shorter, we'll have a video to share with you that was produced in a partnership that we have created with the Oregon Wildlife Federation, and they are actively supporting our fundraising efforts at this time. The Sturgeon Lake Project is the primary sponsor is U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and they have pledged $5 million to help save Sturgeon Lake and restore connectivity between the Columbia River and Sturgeon Lake that has been reduced substantially over the past several decades as a result of the navigational river channel deepening, the levee that was constructed to protect the south half of Savia Island 70 years ago, and, of course, the modulation of the spring freshets of the Columbia River because of the hydroelectric system created primarily for flood control, but irrigation and also power generation. And folks on Savia Island certainly throughout the region have benefited from that. But it's had a terrible adverse impact on floodplains throughout critical stretches of the Columbia and the Willamette River. And Savia Island is sort of the floodplain of the Willamette River, sort of right at the apex where several of our resource agencies, local and federal, have, through surveys the past two or three years, confirmed that particularly for migratory salmonids, this stretch of the river is important for many reasons. And Sturgeon Lake, as a floodplain lake, provides essential habitat not only for aquatic species, but it's really critical to meet our treaty obligations as a country pursuant to the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. There are millions of migratory waterfowl, geese, ducks, cranes. You'll see in the written materials that I've distributed to you a whole lot more background information. So our district, if I may, West Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District, is everything on the west side of the Willamette River in Multnomah County and all of Savia Island. So we go from Lake Oswego to Scappoose. We're about the size of a state senate district in terms of population, 127,000 constituents. It's 88,000 acres, half urban, half rural. And that's probably enough for an introduction. West Multnomah Soil and Conservation District has been working on this project for over 25 years. We are the local sponsor. We are required to come up with a local funding match above $5 million put on the table by the Corps of Engineers. We have raised about 85% of the local match, and we're here to present the status report, share why we think it's significant to the work that you do in terms of restoration of habitat throughout this essential ESA habitat, and perhaps suggest ways that you can direct state agencies to work with us and to provide essential support when necessary. So with that not so brief introduction, I guess we'll go to the video. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
In the 6.5 years I've been manager of the district, helping to save Sturgeon Lake has been one of our top priorities. Savia Island is about the same size as Manhattan, just over 24,000 acres. And it's about the same dimensions, east, west, north, south. And Sturgeon Lake is the largest lake within an island in a freshwater river in the United States. There are very few places in the world like this in terms of the kind of unique habitat and environment.
It's very significant for out-migrating juvenile salmon heading to the ocean as a rearing and a way stop for them as they head out to the ocean to get bigger and fatter and healthier before they go out there. So.
Sturgeon Lake and Savia Island are a critical link in the Pacific Flyway.
Millions of migratory birds traverse up and down the Pacific coast from Alaska all the way to South America and Central America. And this is kind of a critical stopping point for those waterfowl. Sabi Island gets 800,000 visitors a year, which is huge. Everybody, it seems like, wants to be on Sabi Island some point during the summer. There are 2 million people who live within an hour of this place.
We're about 12 miles from Portland right now. It wasn't so hazy, and there wasn't some trees in the way. You could probably see the skyscrapers from here.
And the beaches are phenomenal. The kayaking, the canoeing, the birding in the fall and winter. The hunters are out here at the duck ponds. The agriculture out here, the U-pick. It's just an amazing experience for everyone that comes out here, and it's increasingly popular.
Island's great. You know, it's 20 minutes from town, but it's truly a different place when you cross that bridge every night. It's like a big load comes off. But I live on the island. It's a very important place to me. And my youngest son is named Reeder, which is the road that circles Sabi Island. As a waterfowl guy, having been out here in the peak of the season, to see 15, 20, 25,000 waterfowl inhabiting this piece of water, it's breathtaking. That's why this project is so exciting. But just in general, the things that we've done opened up, you know, tons of land along the Deschutes for public access, for fishing. We built some great boat ramps, the educational piece for kids. I have small children. I just think it's important, especially in today's digital age, that we teach them a little bit about what's going on out here.
The mission of Oregon Wildlife is to empower the lasting conservation of Oregon's fish and wildlife and enjoyment of our natural resources. And we do that in a number of different ways, mostly by being a partner to other organizations and helping them both recruit resources but also bring needed public attention to important projects that are happening around the state. Sturgeon Lake is such an important place for wildlife and fish. And in that regard, and being so close to the Portland area, it's just a natural for us to get involved and try to restore this connection, which is so important.
We're here at the Reeder Road crossing of Dairy Creek, which is a critical point of connection between the Columbia River and Sturgeon Lake. And restoring connectivity between the Columbia River and Sturgeon Lake is really essential to saving Sturgeon Lake in the decades ahead. The culverts are failing. We can see that. They are a fish barrier now. They need to be replaced, and that's a first critical part of this project.
So we're at the mouth of Dairy Creek, and this is the main inlet for Sturgeon Lake from the Columbia River. It has a large sand plug in the mouth that is now preventing that flow from entering the lake. And so this will be a very critical part of any project moving forward. And my hope is that, you know, people outside of the island that use it will come forward and support, as well as there's many corporations nearby and in Northwest Portland that I think could contribute and make a difference.
So if you enjoy fishing, or you enjoy hunting, or if you just enjoy seeing wildlife, the loss of Sturgeon Lake should really matter to you. This is a really big project. This is a $7 million project. The community commitment in order to make this project work is actually $365,000. That's an amazing leverage of resources. If we can raise $365,000, we get a project that's worth many, many, many times that. And it's a project that has a long-lasting impact on not just our ability to enjoy Sturgeon Lake and enjoy Sabi Island the way we currently do, but for future generations to enjoy it like we have. We've got a relatively steep timeline on this. We need to get most of these dollars raised by March of next year. So we got to get cracking, and we hope you'll help.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. That was first presented about 3 months ago on June 7th at the annual fundraising auction for the Oregon Wildlife Heritage Foundation. And many of you may know that former Governor Picatinny was very active in that organization, and I was honored. It was my last opportunity to greet Governor Atiyah and to thank him for his service and for his support for protection of natural resources. So this is kind of moving to me in many ways because of his commitment to this organization and this work as well, for which I think he only recently has begun to receive adequate recognition. But moving right along, I'd like you to think of this as emblematic of the work that soil and water conservation districts and watershed councils are doing across the state. I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, are familiar with the work that's being done in your communities. And we have a very close working relationship with the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. We try to meet in training sessions regularly. This coming Saturday, Center House, I'm going to be going out to North Plains for the Tualatin Soil and Water Conservation District, our annual tour of restoration sites and barbecue. And this kind of cooperation is really critical. And they're doing wonderful work all across the state. I know the work you're familiar with the sage-grouse crisis down in south east Oregon, in the Gorge, in the Willamette Valley, Jackson County. Tremendous work is being done by your soil and water conservation districts. And we're just here as a representative to share with you how fortunate we are to have this opportunity. Again, this has been a commitment for my organization for over 25 years. We're very fortunate the voters allowed us a very modest tax base in the fall of 2006. Our annual budget is about $2 million a year. And we've been very successful so far in meeting the local match. And I'm pleased to report to you that just last week, we were informed that Metro is going to award us $100,000 to our goal as the local match. And I'll be appearing out in Tigard Thursday before the Metro City Council as one of several grant recipients to accept that award officially. There's a lot of work going on Savi Island. I know your time is brief. I'll wrap up here by pointing out that last Thursday's Portland Tribune has a lead story, Old Mill Goes Wild Thanks to Polluters. This is the Alder Creek Lumber Mill at the south side of Savi Island. Wildlands, Inc. has committed to a multi-million dollar restoration project there in anticipation of reimbursement from potentially responsible polluters as part of the Oregon Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup. This is they're moving 400,000 cubic yards of material and are going to recreate 28 acres of wetland outside the levee at the south end, just adjacent to Linton and the Portland Superfund Harbor. So we're all watching this restoration work. It's getting a lot of attention. We're making a lot of progress to save Sturgeon Lake. We hope that if we find it necessary, that we may be able to report back to you and ask for additional assistance, possibly from the Department of State Lands and the State Land Board, who are the owner, ultimately, of this public trust resource. Thank you all very much, and I'd certainly be pleased to answer any questions you have.
Thanks, Dick. So how much are you short at this point?
According to the Corps of Engineers estimate, we are $265,000 short.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
I've been to the lake. I fished the lake. Gilbert River is amazing opportunity to boat and be in there. The inflow is Deary Creek. Is the outflow going to be the Gilbert River?
Yes, it will be primarily. The hydrology here is almost as complicated as trying to pull together all the different responsible parties, because there's the Gilbert River up at the north end, as you know, flows into Multnomah Channel, and it's tidally influenced, and you get a pretty good current there in terms of coming in and out of the north access to the lake. There's a three-hour difference in the tidal peak and cycle between the north and there at Gilbert Creek and where Sturgeon Lake is. And the best the hydrologists can figure is will probably encourage more flow in, and that will reduce the likelihood that sediment will continue to settle in the lake. It's kind of a trial and error process. I don't think any biologist is going to guarantee you a result. I mean, we have learned a lot, and we're still learning, and I think that's one of the reasons that BPA, Multnomah County, and others, including Metro, are prepared to make this investment because we know we're going to learn something one way or the other, and we're prepared to move forward. And your support certainly would mean a lot to us as well.
Brief follow-up. Are you going to dredge?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to dredge?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson.
No, not a problem.
We are. That's the second stage of the project. We've got those failed culverts we've got to replace first. That's the only source of access to the north part of the island for people,
right,
for emergency response, as you know, for the beaches, nude or otherwise, to the boat ramp. So a lot of people want to be out there all times of the year. So that's the first step. And then we'll rechannelize the connection about 1,700 feet between those failed culverts and the river itself. And if I may, Mr. Chair, I did also include in your package something I thought that might be of interest to you from the state of Washington. 2 years ago, they adopted their Floodplain Management Act and program. It's phenomenal. They got $50 million committed to this. Their Department of Ecology is responsible. And I'm thinking, you know, DSL is really strapped for resources. Maybe it's time we reconsider how we deal with floodplains in our region as well. Maybe we can learn something from our neighbors. I know I did in years past.
Thank you, Dave. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you all, Mr. Chair and members. Really appreciate your attention and the opportunity to appear before you.
Great to have you. Thanks. Okay. Let's move to the next item, which is an update on the Senate Bill 306 clean air fee study. And we've got a whole team here. Mazen, were you going to kick this off, or we're running short on chairs up here?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christine Broniak. I'm with the Legislative Revenue Office. I'm working with Mazen as well on this project. As you know, Senate Bill 306 in 2013 had directed the Legislative Revenue Office to develop a study of a carbon tax or a clean air tax to see what kinds of impacts it might have statewide. There are some materials in OLIS, both slides from the presentation as well as a letter, outlining the progress to date on this type of study. This will be the last presentation prior to the release of the final report on November 15th. So we will be taking feedback until that time on the progress of the report. We've been meeting extensively with stakeholders as well as an interagency advisory committee in order to get direction and receive direction for the report. There will be various possibilities to mitigate the impact on various socioeconomic groups, and particularly low-income people. And so we'll be looking at some repatriation scenarios, and that's ways to give the revenue perhaps back to low-income groups in order to mitigate some of the negative impacts of the carbon tax on those people. And we'll be able to evaluate impacts on various industry sectors, and this would be through economic modeling scenarios for both collection of the tax and repatriation. And also we'll be able to evaluate impacts for various regions of the state. And so with me today I have Dr. Tom Patowski, who is from Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State University, and he will and the team will outline the various issues and some of the progress that's been made so far on the study.
Okay, Dr. Patowski, welcome.
Welcome.
So what's the forecast for the study?
It will be completed November 15th. good afternoon. Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the Senate we were just at the Finance and Revenue Committee. Senate Environmental and Natural Resource Committee. As Christine described to you, and I'm going to go right into the study in lieu of the time that we have with you today, we really are looking at two very, very broad results. And that's what we were asked to do. Essentially, if a carbon tax or fee was implemented in Oregon, what would be the economic impacts and what would be the greenhouse gas emission impacts? And under those two broad areas, the Senate Bill 306 has a broad type of analysis and issues that they want answered under those two very broad issues of economic impacts and the greenhouse gas emission impacts. So let me start going right into our first slide here, and one of the features of the report as we are to answer to Senate Bill 306. And one is the identification of an effective administrative structure. Here, we're basically philosophically saying, you know, how can we reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the least cost? What sort of administrative setup would be able to do that? Now, we're going to be looking at the combustion of carbon content type fuels in Oregon, plus we're going to be looking at electricity. We'll be looking at the wholesale level for many of the fuel types. For electricity, we will likely be looking at the final consumption of that. But as we're looking at this, we want to make sure that the administrative way of doing this is going to be one where it's the most effective in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, in that that should be basically the only cost of doing business that the greenhouse gas, that the carbon tax or fee implemented on businesses should happen. There shouldn't be a great burden, say, of reporting how to report the actual taxes paid. And so we're looking at a very cost effectiveness of the administration. We would like to see if there is a way to put this together where you're not creating a whole new department to administer this tax. Allocated resources presently available in Department of Revenue be able to do this as an example, and how we might formulate that so that we mitigated much the administrative cost of implementing this. So in our earlier study, as Christine mentioned, we had looked at very broadly the entire state of Oregon, and we only had four industrial sectors. And now what we want to do is really take a look, peel back, you know, the onion skin here, and take a look right at the state. And we're going to be breaking the state down, as we see in this diagram here, into six regions. And within those regions, we're going to be looking at incomes of households, and we're going to break those households into five different income groups. This will enable us then to take a look at industry mixes, not just overall in the state, but in each region, because our expectation is that the industry mixes are different in regions, and thus the impact from a carbon tax or fee would likely be different also. The same is true in terms of the income groups for each of these regions. So we'll be able to look at industry impacts overall, state, six regions, income households, five different income groups per region. Next. So rather than four very broad industries like we had in our first study, we're looking at seven industrial sectors. And also in our use of modeling, and Jeff is going to emphasize a little more about the economic modeling and a model form called REMI that we're using, it allows really for much more dynamic interaction of businesses. And also the ability for possible businesses to pass on the tax that is implemented upon them to possible households and other final users. Also in Senate Bill 306 identified there were five broad target areas. These come from the from Business Oregon, and they're the outdoor gear and activewear area, high technology, forestry and wood products, advanced manufacturing, and clean technology. So besides the 70 sectors, we'll also be grouping these and looking at these particular impacts for these five key sectors. But that means we'll still, though, be looking at like agriculture, transportation, government sectors, other manufacturing sectors will be available for the analysis. Next slide. Now, before we put together the entire methodology of how to do this. We were very careful, worked very strongly with LRO, and we formulated a stakeholder group list that we wanted to reach out to get their opinions about the methodology that we may be undertaking. And so we reached out to various business groups, example, Oregon Business Association, but also other private companies, talked with Nike, talked with Intel as examples. We also reached out to utilities. Utilities are definitely going to be impacted by the implementation of this tax. So we talked Northwest Natural, PacifiCorp, PGE, and many of the public utility districts, for example, EWEB down in Eugene. We also talked to a lot of groups that will be impacted by this. Low-income households, as examples, we talked with Northwest Pilot Project, the Oregon Opportunity Network, groups dealing with homelessness and also with low-income housing aspects, and also various labor groups, representatives of the AFL-CIO and other groups. And then finally, to assist us, we also formulated a technical advisory committee. And this technical advisory committee is made up of members from the Legislative Fiscal Office, Department of Transportation, the Public Utility Commission, definitely Department of Revenue, and also Department of Energy for Oregon and DEQ. And with that, that's sort of a very brief and quick introduction. I'm going to let each of our members formally identify themselves. And I don't think I identified myself, did I, when we started off?
Who are you?
I am Tom Petowski, director of the Northwest Economic Research Center, located at Portland State University.
Thank you, Dr. Petowski. Before you begin, Mr. Renfro, Vice Chair Olson has a question.
Thank you, Dr. Petowski. Just one question on your stakeholder outreach. Did you reach any of the middle-income folks that this is going to impact? Did you have any groups that represented the middle-income folks?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, specifically, I would say no. In that there were some, and Jeff, maybe you can help me on this. There were some special interest groups, citizens groups that we also met with that would be concerned with energy prices, but I would say not directly.
Thank you.
Great. So for the record, I'm Jeff Renfro. I'm the senior economist at the Northwest Economic Research Center. And I'm going to talk to you about how we are actually performing the economic modeling. So this is a schematic that shows the process we're going through. We're basically doing this in two parts. So on the front end, we're calculating expected change in energy price due to the carbon tax. We're seeing how that affects emissions and economic activity. We're feeding that into an emission model that Andrew and Chris will talk to you more about. We're calculating tax revenue that we expect to make, and then we're recycling or repatriating that back into the economy, and it's an iterative process in the modeling. So to start with, we use the Energy Information Administration's energy price forecast for the Northwest region. We prorate this for Oregon. So we take our baseline for the price of natural gas and then for petroleum products from this. We handle electricity differently. I'll talk about that a little bit more later. So we have an expected price going out to 2034 for our energy products. And then based on the carbon price that we're using, we build in an expected price increase. That price increase is due to the carbon content of the fuel we're thinking about, and then it's built on top of that price forecast. Those inputs go into REMI. As Tom mentioned, we have a six-region economic modeling software called REMI. I'll go into that a little bit more later, but the reason we're using this time is REMI is fully dynamic. In our earlier study, we were missing a lot of the industry pass-through effects that are going to be really important in the final outcomes of a policy like this. So within our model, we have our regions of the state interacting with each other, and then within those regions, and then between the regions, we have the industries and households fully interacting, passing on costs. So from REMI, we take expected change in fuel demand for each of our fuel types, and then expected change in output by industry by region. We feed that into our Oregon emission model. That ends up calculating expected change in emission due to change in energy demand and output. When we get an updated emissions forecast, it's pretty simple to apply a factor to that and calculate the revenue we expect to get from that. So the main way that the revenue is then returned to the economy is through personal and corporate income tax cuts. We also know that based on the way the laws currently stand, any carbon tax that comes from transportation fuels would have to go with the normal gas tax funds. So regular gas tax expenditures are also built into the model. In addition to that, we're also looking at repatriation and expenditure scenarios that include fee and dividend approach, capital gains reduction, additional low-income assistance, support for nonprofit and government agencies, business and household energy efficiency projects, an increase in government general funds, exemption of the identified traded sectors that Tom mentioned before, and then additional support for rural residents. So I'm going to go into a few of the areas that we spent a considerable amount of time on. So this is a schematic of one part of how REMI works. It's not important for me to totally walk through this right now, and I'm not going to do that. But if you'll notice, the main box on the top and then the centerpiece of that box is output, right? So economic output is connected to basically every other part of the economy. So when we were going through the initial version of the model, we discovered some discrepancies. The way that REMI estimates output by industry, we found that they were overestimating output in some Oregon industries and then underestimating in others. So an example, the original REMI model found that Oregon had a robust oil and gas extraction industry, and coal and petroleum manufacturing was doing well here. And then the high tech, the positive impact of the high tech sector was not as pronounced as it should be. And it's based on the way that REMI just allocates output across industries. In other states, it works very well, but there were just a few kind of odd Oregon things here. So we actually worked with REMI to build in output estimates by industry from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. And as a result of that, REMI updated our model. They also updated the Legislative Revenue Office's REMI model. And then in the future, when they're building models for other states, they're going to adopt the methodology that we worked on together. Another really important piece is, so the carbon content of electricity varies quite a bit across regions in Oregon and then varies between utilities. So we needed to come up with region and utility-specific carbon contents to calculate the expected impact on electricity prices due to the tax. So the way that we did this is we collected data from the Department of Energy, the Public Utility Commission, and then the utilities integrated resource plans. So we were able to create a forecast of carbon content and then prices going out to 2034. And then we used mapping files from Bonneville Power to map out the utility service areas around Oregon. So what we ended up finding is utility service areas don't respect county and city boundaries as we had hoped they would. So we have a handful of utilities that are just sitting right on top of our regional boundaries. So we did a data request for several utilities, and all of them very graciously responded to our data request. So we were able to take the electricity delivered by each utility and allocate it to the appropriate region. So once we knew how much electricity each utility was sending to each region, and then for every year what we expected the carbon content of that electricity to be, for every year we can create sort of a weighted average that shows the expected average carbon content of that region. So with that baseline, then we can apply price increases due to a carbon tax to each one of our regions. We can do it in a way that's regionally specific. Tom mentioned we're specifically tasked with looking at differences in impacts of the tax for different household income levels. So we've created a series of worksheets where we've split the population of each one of our six regions into five income quintiles. So for each income quintile in each region, we're able to calculate the expected negative income effect of higher energy prices, and then also the expected positive benefit of tax cuts or whichever repatriation or expenditure method we're using on the back end. So for each income class in each region, we have an expected net effect of any of these policies. This is incredibly important because in Oregon, the households making the least amount of money spend about 25% of their income on energy purchases, whereas households making the most money spend about 4 or 6%. So we know right from the start that a tax like this is going to hit lower-income households harder than everyone else. The last bit I'll talk about, in SB 306, there's a Section J, which lists a whole series of existing environmental laws here in Oregon. So we've been tasked with looking at how those existing laws would interact with a carbon tax. So the way that we've approached this is for each law, we've written a summary of basically what the law's intention was. We've taken we call it an Econ 101 approach to it. So we explain the economic theory behind why you would institute an environmental policy like this. And then we have also collected existing research. Most of these statutes have a good amount of research, and they've been studied quite a bit. So we know what the impact of each one of these statutes are up to this point. And then we have a discussion of how these existing laws would interact with a carbon tax. So the bulk of this section is a fairly long report with a detailed discussion of these interactions. But then we recognize that not everyone is going to wade through all of this fairly complex information. So the front of this section is going to be sort of a simple infographic that breaks down very briefly the purpose of each one of the existing laws. We're going to break interaction types into a small number of categories. So does a carbon tax make an existing policy redundant? Do they work together to achieve overlapping goals? Things of that nature. Where there is already a calculated implicit or explicit carbon price associated with one of these existing laws, we'll report that. Where that didn't exist, we've calculated our own implicit carbon prices, and then just odds and ends in the notes section at the end. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris and Andrew to talk about our emissions model. This is a question.
Yeah, Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you. That's a great presentation. I'm following it here on OLIS. Question is, those people that are unfortunate enough to be serviced by investor-owned utilities, will they be impacted greater than those that get their energy from Bonneville Power Administration because that it's clean energy? And how do you balance that with your carbon tax?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson. Yes, the tax would be based on the carbon content of the electricity. For a variety of reasons, we think that for electricity, you would need to apply the tax at the level of the final consumer. Investor-owned utilities in Oregon tend to have a higher carbon content. The main motivation of having this tax is to incentivize either utilities or customers to behave in a way that reflects the actual carbon content associated with the energy that they're using. So we would expect utilities to react and try to reduce the carbon content of the electricity. We'd expect customers in the investor-owned utility service areas probably to do more to reduce their electricity usage.
Yeah, follow up. The problem with that is that we're not privy to where our investor-owned utility gets their electricity at, and where you move is predicated on, you know, who you get. Within a half a mile of me, there's a COU, which their electric rates are much cheaper, and so I'm penalized from where I live, not on anything else. And there's no way to balance that.
Vice Chair Olson, I think I can imagine a way to sort of equalize the cost across different utilities. You'd really be eliminating the strength of your price signal. So I think that you would be, if there was just sort of one Oregon-wide average carbon content and everyone paid carbon tax on their electricity related to that, then you would lose the incentive for higher carbon content utilities to reduce that carbon content. And then you could make a case that people consuming lower carbon content electricity would be punished because of the behavior of others. So I understand the criticism, but I think that if you are going to institute this policy in a way that really reflects the carbon content associated with people's behavior, I don't know if there's any way around it.
I think that's a very, very fair series of questions that you're asking, Vice Chair. I think we're going to, but it's a little premature, I think, for us to get into it. But we will have to, definitely have to talk about those as we're thinking about next steps and recommendations.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembrow, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andrew Rice, Department of Physics at Portland State University. I'm just going to give an overview with the slide here of the emissions modeling, kind of the 10,000-foot level, if you will, and allow Chris to get into a little bit of the details for you, kind of open the hood, if you will. So, but the main objectives are, as Tom stated earlier, to really calculate the impact of a carbon tax on fossil fuel greenhouse gas emissions. And we do this relative to the scenario where there's no carbon tax for Oregon, obviously. We also have a second objective, and that's to look at the tax revenue generated from a carbon tax imposed, and I'll walk you through that in a second. So we start with carbon tax scenarios. We use several future carbon tax scenarios that slowly ramp up in cost from $10 to $150. Those are the maximum values per metric ton of CO2. So those are the scenarios we put then into the economic model that we feed into the regional economic model, that's the REMI model that both Tom and Jim talked about, built specifically for Oregon here. It provides as output estimates of how fuel demand will change under the different scenarios. So fuel demand in dollars will change in the future. Now, fuel is broken down within the REMI model into categories: electricity, natural gas, residual fuels. Residual fuels are primarily motor gasoline and fuel oil, but do include things like jet fuel, a few others. Fuel demand in REMI, some of the power of REMI, again, is it has 70 economic sectors and 6 regions of Oregon and goes forward in time. So we relate this now, how we go from fuel demand to greenhouse gas emissions. We use something called fuel-specific emissions factors. This is basically carbon intensities, which provide essentially a conversion between, say, BTU of fuel to carbon dioxide equivalents, or kilowatt hours to carbon dioxide equivalents. I should note here that we consider only in-boundary emissions for the state. So any kind of upstream fuel supply issues are not included. This is the convention for DEQ, for the US EPA. Electricity is treated a little bit independently, not only for the reason Jeff mentioned, but it does include emissions that are associated with power generation out of state that is provided to the state, which we have here in Oregon. So again, power consumed in Oregon, all power consumed in Oregon with electricity.
So it doesn't include the carbon used to create goods that are then imported into Oregon, other than electricity.
Chair Dembrow, that's correct, yes. Electricity emissions factors also, as Jeff got into, do vary by region. I think you talked enough about that. As a result of the utility districts, we use, again, utility-specific emissions factors projected into the future. Greenhouse gas emissions are then calculated, again, by economic sector, by region, by year. We also get, of course, we get state totals just from aggregation of economic sectors and regions by year. So that's the first three red balls up there. The last one is tax revenue. It's actually trivial at this point. Once you have greenhouse gas emissions and you have the carbon tax imposed, you can calculate the total tax revenue generated as a result of the carbon tax that's imposed. So that's pretty much the broad overview. Chris is going to talk some of the details.
Okay, thanks. Chris, before you begin, the cost of, per whatever, the $10 to $150, where is the British Columbia price point? And did it start and then it went up?
Chair Dembrow, I believe it started at 5. Sorry. Correction, 10, and went up to 30. It is now at 30.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, thank you, Chair Dembrow, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christopher Butenhoff. I'm an assistant professor at Portland State University. So what, next slide, please. So I do apologize for putting one equation on the slide. I'm a physicist, so I need at least one equation per slide. I'm beginning to prepare my class, too. So I wanted to quickly just kind of walk you through, very briefly, kind of the methodology of how we calculate emissions. So if you were to focus your attention on the bottom of the slide with that equation, emissions we calculate in units of tons per CO2 equivalent. And for those of you not familiar with that unit, that does include both methane, nitrous oxide, and some of the other high global warming potential gases. So these other gases are converted into what's called a CO2 equivalent by using what's called a global warming potential, which is a reflection of how much global warming those gases are causing. So emissions are simply how much of that fuel is used. So one example we could use is natural gas. In the city of Oregon, we could use the unit of BTU for natural gas, and then we simply multiply that by an emission factor. And again, emission factor, as Jeff and Andrew have talked about, is another name for carbon intensity. For natural gas, we can think of that as how many tons of CO2 equivalent are being used for every BTU of natural gas consumed. So that's our kind of our basic equation. This is a standard equation that DEQ, DOE uses for their official state inventory. It's a well-recognized basis for calculating emissions. So when we calculate the emissions based upon the carbon tax scenario, one important thing to recognize is that this forecast of emissions with the implementation of carbon tax is relative to a baseline case. So baseline case here simply means that this is a projection of emissions without a carbon tax. So that's the first step in this process, is first figuring out what is a projection of Oregon energy emissions with no carbon tax. And so for this process, we're really trying to get at the best available Oregon-specific data. Much of the work that we've been doing for the emissions modeling is really just trying to get the best Oregon-specific data we have about Oregon's energy needs. So for the baseline data, we have mainly two different sources for that. One is the Oregon Department of Energy. They've put together a spreadsheet of projections of retail utility sales for electricity. And that, in turn, is based upon projections by the BPA, the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and DEQ. So that provides us with a baseline projection of what Oregon retail sales are for electricity. Along with that, we have natural gas and petroleum or residual fuel projections that we take from the EIA, the U.S. Department of Energy, Energy Information Administration's data set, and this is prorated for Oregon. So again, the point here is just to recognize that we're using Oregon-specific data to calculate our baseline. Then the other point in that equation that I just mentioned were these emission factors, these carbon intensities. And again, we've talked already a little bit about the electricity component. Electricity is a little bit odd since each region does have a different mix of fuel sources that go into the electricity. Not only does that affect the fuel prices, that affects how much carbon emission or carbon equivalent emissions are coming from every kilowatt hour consumed by a citizen in that region. So again, we go back to the IOU IRPs for that information, and based upon the carbon intensities of the fuel mixes, we can then calculate a region-specific emission factor to calculate the regional emissions. So that kind of gives us the baseline emissions. So at this point, we now have a baseline emissions at state level. And what we do, we allocate those emissions to each of these 70 different economic sectors. And we do that based upon the REMI modeling, all right? And the REMI modeling allows us to get at how much fuel is purchased by each of these sectors in each region. So that's the metric that we use then to distribute the statewide emissions to these 70 sectors and regions. So that's our baseline forecast. So the second step of the modeling then is, once you impose the carbon tax, how does the fuel price change and how does the fuel purchase change? Both of those are important factors that go into the change in fuel demand. So once we know the change in fuel demand, once we impose the carbon tax, we can simply adjust the baseline emissions for the change in fuel demand. And so that's why the second box I label as the adjusted emissions. These are emissions adjusted for the carbon tax relative to the baseline case. So what is the final product of all this? Well, the final product is really forecasts, if you will, scenarios of greenhouse gas emissions, again, both carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, all converted to the same unit for each of these 70 sectors in Oregon, bioregion, for every year up until the year 2034. This then allows us to compare the implications of a carbon tax for emissions relative to a no carbon tax scenario. Thank you.
Great. Okay, Tom, are you going to wrap up then?
Senator Hess has
Go ahead and finish.
No.
Okay. Yes. So just to wrap up, you know, just as Chris finished there with the emissions per tons per carbon dioxide equivalent, then you have a carbon tax or fee associated with that. You get the revenue, and then what is done with that revenue? How is it possibly repatriated back? Jeff described various ways of doing that, lowering business taxes, lowering personal income taxes, home efficiency projects, all sorts of different aspects of what could be done. That gets fed back in the model. How does that affect the businesses? Once again, if you repatriate taxes back, how does it affect households? How does that affect their use of fuel demands? How does that affect emissions? And we continue on through time as to how that all gets settled. Just to wrap up, you know, I think it's very important that we've been, I think, very good due diligence in using the REMI model. We really did customize it for Oregon so that it's very Oregon-specific, and we've been very careful in doing that. We have an emissions model now that is also very Oregon-specific. We really want to thank the utilities for their input in providing us with helping their sort of fuel mix that comes into these different regions. Because without that, we would not have been able to be as specific into the regional impacts as we'd like to be. And then, so what we'll be doing is November 15th, we'll be getting a final report. Before we do that, we will be having drafts going back to the stakeholder groups we've talked about and getting feedback and so on for that. And then finally, delivering the product to LRO and then further presentations both to your committee, possibly in December and also into the next legislative year.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. So do you see the report including recommendations for next steps for us? You know, we have a session coming up in February, and, you know, will the report have a discussion of outstanding policy issues that, you know, maybe will need to be explored, resolved, you know, in setting up the next steps for this program?
Yes, Chair Dembro. Yes, a number of issues. Besides what we'll be showing you to various scenarios of right. outcomes, there are a number of issues. For example, we're talking about the state of Oregon. Are there going to be border issues?
Right.
Would there be likeliness of businesses moving because of the tax or not? There is the issue legally of the is this a gas tax, and thus that portion that's
right.
a gas tax, and where does that money go? It may not be able to be repatriated back to the general fund somehow, and reducing other taxes. It may be earmarked for roads, as an example. So those are like just two of the issues, and then low income also. How is that repatriated back? Where should possibly that cutoff be for low income, where they are provided with either a rebate somehow, given that they generally pay a higher percent of their income in energy items than higher income households do?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Senator Hess.
Thank you. I have a comment and a question. First, I just want to thank you, Tom, and your team. I think this is exactly the kind of sophisticated analysis that the Revenue Committee was looking at when we were crashing around there a year ago. And in fact, it's exactly what I visualized as seeing these three young professors in dark suits sitting there. It's like it's like Men in Black or something. And it's just great. And I think one of the more compelling things for a lot of legislators is this revenue neutral part of it. And so that there won't be more revenue, it's just going to be, as you say, repatriated. And that does set up a very, really interesting, almost tantalizing kind of policy issue there, where you do low income, you talk about the burden, and you mentioned capital gains and some other things. So when I'm thinking about that, and I don't want to veer too much into the Revenue Committee, but it does make me think, well, what kind of dough are we talking about here? When you look at this, I know it's early. Are we talking about tens of millions, hundreds of millions, thousands of millions?
Billions.
And billions.
Thousands of millions
and
billions, yeah.
Senator Chair Dembro, Senator Haas, I'll let Jeff answer, but the short answer, of course, is it depends.
Yeah. Chair Dembro, Senator Haas, yes, it depends on the price. According to our initial research, at a price of $60 per ton, we would expect the revenue high mark to get up around $2 billion. So you can imagine change the price. It's not exactly linear, but it's close to that relationship. We haven't completed the results for the new study, but my expectation is we're going to be in that ballpark when we're looking at the Oregon-wide impacts.
Great. Vice Chair.
As you, I don't want to say put pressure on utilities to change their energy production. As they change, that's a capital asset that they get to recoup profits on. And so you're going to drive up energy costs just by making a company go from a coal plant to a gas plant. Does this reflect in this? How would you balance that off for the people that are going to have to pay more money because we're forcing them to use different fuels? Will this calculate that? Or will this...
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson. So there is a discrepancy here, right? So what we end up calculating it, but we calculate it as if they're doing it sort of step by step, when in reality it's going to be wait, huge investment, and then live with that. So in the aggregate, we're capturing that. But then how it actually works, because it's a one time or a very limited number of times kind of discrete choice, our modeling, we won't be able to say, you know, it's going to happen in this year and this will be the effect after it. But the overall effect over time, we will be capturing that.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, the tough part here overall is that, you know, we have these greenhouse gas emissions and no one owns them. They do incur a cost. And if we internalize that cost, you know, then it's how do we pay for it? We're actually putting it in like a cost of doing business now, rather than it's a cost that we're having health-wise and so on that is occurring. And not to make a claim if it's climate change or not, but if we believe that those costs are out there, internalizing them, then we have to pay for them. And some of the issues here is what's the most efficient way of sort of paying for those, and we think a carbon tax is a good way to do that. But along with these efficiency issues, as you've brought up, there's equity issues. What is the fairest way of doing this, of internalizing these costs?
Yeah, and the reason, yes, question? Yes. The reason I bring that up is that you have PGE and PacifiCorp overlap in the same area of Portland, and PGE is not as reliant on coal as PacifiCorp is. So therefore, you have two classes of people, could be right across the street. One would be paying significantly more energy prices or carbon tax than the guy right across the street, only because of the company he gets electricity from. And so I don't know how we're going to balance that equity.
Well, Vice Chair Olson, so one of the goals of the study is, our hope is that we illustrate that issue really well. So at a lower level of carbon price, the discrepancy between the different utilities is probably going to be relatively small. As the price goes up, yeah, you will see big gaps. And if it creates a situation where the gaps or the differences in the increase in energy prices seem arbitrary, then we want to tell you this is what's going to happen. This is something that needs to be dealt with. I think that there are probably ways to deal with this, but our goal is to really finely illustrate this point and then let policymakers decide what the best way to handle the equity issues are.
That is the whole point of the study, is to give us the information that we can make before we start wrestling with these policy decisions. Yes, Senator Bates.
Just real quickly, I apologize for coming in late. I had to go to another committee. And so you don't mind if you start over, do you? I like Senator Hass, I'm really tantalized by this. In Southern Oregon, rural Oregon, our problem there is poverty and jobs. We need to do everything we can to encourage businesses to move there and to encourage our businesses that we have there to expand. We need a better educated workforce, and we need probably a reduction in some of those taxes on those businesses to encourage more to come in. If this is really, truly would be neutral as far as the total cost to the state, and we can rejuvenate parts of the state which have been in trouble since 1979, I would see this as a real, really big win. I could think of things going on in Pendleton and Ontario and LeGrand and places that have been totally dependent on natural resources but have a lot of things they could be doing there other than natural resources. But our job, our problem is it all goes to Portland, it all goes to Eugene, it goes to where bigger centers are. We need help out there, and if this could be worked in that way, I think we have a lot of support for it. But it's talk about the devil in the details. Oh, my God. I mean, this is really going to be tough to look at and going to be really complicated. But the potential is there. Also, sitting on the California border, I know what electricity costs in California compared to Oregon. We're starting at a very low rate on electrical rates to start with. And we've all gotten kind of used to that. But it gives us some, I believe it gives us some leeway, something we can work with here that might really work well for all the people of Oregon. So I'm very tantalized, I'm very interested. Got to look, get a little more information, and I'm looking forward to your next presentation. Now, Mr. Chair, it's going to be in December?
Most likely. The report is due in November. I'm sure we're going to want to hear about it.
Okay.
Great. Okay, the last question, Representative Holby.
All right, I got the last question. I'm trying to figure out if I can make this question make sense, first of all, trying to wrap my head around this, but I'm assuming that your physicists will figure out the formula, or you are looking at, because I was kind of interested in that Section J piece where you're looking at the interactions of future utility emission standards that, such as the type that are being contemplated by the EPA currently, 111D emission standards, and how those incrementally increase. I would guess that your carbon tax would incrementally maybe decrease according if those were actually in place and something you could count on and factor into your formulas. Is that kind of what you're talking about, is the interaction of those types of standards in its impact on a potentially dynamic carbon tax instead of a set carbon tax?
You want to take it? Right, grab it.
Chair Dembro, Representative Holby. I have to answer this in a little bit of a roundabout way. But our baseline energy use and energy price forecast is based on an Energy Information Administration forecast called the Extended Policy Forecast. It includes everything that's already on the books. And when we took this one as opposed to their reference case, it assumes that policies that have a sunset but are always renewed will continue to be renewed. Environmental standards that are changed over time will continue to be changed over time. So if anything like that was already in place is factored into this. So with 111D, we spoke with our technical advisory committee at one of our meetings specifically about this issue, and the Department of Energy is still figuring out what exactly Oregon's response to 111D is going to be. I think it's going to be a long time before we figure out what exactly that is. So our study, we don't have a specific Oregon response to that to build into it at this time, so we won't be reflecting that. But as far as dynamic pricing, when British Columbia, we talked to people up in BC about the implementation of their tax. They took out the dynamic elements that could be there just to make it simple for everyone to understand. So they've hit their cap of $30 per ton. And we've talked to people who say they wish that they had built in a little bit more flexibility. So for us, we're following a similar sort of path. We're looking at all sorts of different caps, but then the path to those caps is equal increments. So it could be that as the carbon tax increases, there are different types of environmental statutes that exist where the carbon tax would, one or the other would make, there would be redundancy, right? So I think that at that point, rather than build in some sort of automatic change, I think it would just be a very complex system, and the benefits of the two different taxes or the two different policies, even if they did overlap to a large extent, there's probably going to be a lot of detail in there that I think policymakers would want to examine before automatically ditching one or ramping one up or down, something like that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for the presentation. Keep up the good work. We look forward to the product and look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you.
Okay. The wolves are howling. Let's bring up our next panel, which is going to give us an update on the Wolf Conservation and Management Plan. We have Ron Anglin, Russ Morgan, Rob Clavins, Todd Nash, and Tom Berkmeyer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gentlemen, kick this off for us, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee. I'm Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today is Russ Morgan, our Wolf Program Coordinator based out of La Grande. And I'm going to just go ahead in interest of time, turn it over to Russ, and let it go from there.
Great.
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee. I'm Russ Morgan. I'm Wolf Program Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And what I'll do today is provide you a brief update of the status of wolves in Oregon and also wolf management activities that are occurring right now. And I'll do that by touching on the five things you see on this screen. So starting with the wolf plan, Oregon's wolf program really essentially started in 2005 when the original Oregon wolf plan was adopted. That plan calls for five-year evaluations and potential updates, and that did occur in 2010 and scheduled to occur in 2015. I might also add that a rule change, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, occurred in 2013. So there have been several updates of the plan. As with everything with wolves, there's a lot of public interest, of course, and virtually every process that we've undertaken in this state regarding wolves has been a very large public involvement in process. So let's get to the good parts, I guess, or the parts people generally are most curious about, and that is, where are we with wolves? How many do we have? It's not unexpected by most that Oregon's wolves are increasing, not just in abundance, but in distribution as well. They're expanding as well as their numbers increasing. We count wolves once a year, so the numbers for 2014 really won't be complete until the end of this calendar year. But what you see on the left-hand graph there really represents wolf management in all of the western United States. And what I mean by that is our population is increasing by roughly a third every year. That has the effect of doubling our population every 2 years. If we look at data across the western U.S., that's almost synonymous with the population trends beginning in the mid-90s. So
how do you calculate, how do you determine the area? What do you mean by the West?
Really what I'm referring to, Chair Dimbrough, is the Northern Rocky Mountains population of wolves that were reintroduced in Idaho and in Yellowstone have expanded, that expansion essentially. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And also would be synonymous in Washington as well. So you see on the left there the actual numbers. On the right-hand graph, you will see number of packs, and those are really those are very analogous to the numbers because most wolves are counted by packs or known packs, known groups of wolves, if you will. And, of course, in the red bars there are the breeding pairs, and what those represent is successful pairs of wolves that have produced young that survive to the end of the year. They become what we refer to, that's an official term, as a breeding pair. So some wolves breed, not all of them become breeding pairs, successful breeding pair. The reason that's important is because it plays into all of our conservation goals that are set forth in the plan. Here's a graphic depiction of where wolves occur in Oregon, where we know they occur. Certainly the system that we have where we count once a year based on evidence that we have, we also know that wolves are secretive animals. They can be found in other areas, places we haven't detected them. This is what we know, actually, as far as groups. What you will see in the upper right is two lighter blue-colored polygons. Those represent two new groups of wolves discovered just this year. And, of course, also interesting to many Oregonians is the down in the south southern Cascades, you see a polygon that's labeled OR7. And, of course, that's a wolf that has met up with a new mate and made quite a lot of had a lot of public interest associated with it as well.
Sure. Where did he meet that that new mate from? If the packs are off to the east, how did he kind of stumble onto her?
Right. Chair Denbro, Senator Olson, what we have found is so far the information we have is from genetics. We collected scat, which is a common way to try to get a hold of genetic samples. One of the things that we have, maybe we're more fortunate in Oregon now than some of the other western states in the beginning, is that we have pretty tremendous databases of wolf genetics from Idaho. And so we can actually go back from genetic samples and trace origin or history, a path of origin. We really couldn't tell on this mate where OR7, we know OR7, of course, came from northeast Oregon, and we put the radio collar on him. The mate we didn't know until just a couple of weeks ago, and the genetic data came back and showed that she's related to two other packs in northeast Oregon, the Snake River and the Minum packs.
But she didn't have a collar.
She doesn't have a collar. So all of that information is purely from genetics, and that's tied then to all the other genetic information we have is the way we can do that.
A follow-up. Would that be typical that one wolf would just wander off like OR7 did, to just wander off, like a female wander off by herself and kind of hunt around and stumble on something like that?
Chair Denbro, Senator Olson, the answer is yes. That is very typical. That's what wolves do. Mm-hmm. So really then when we tie this population to some of the objectives within our current management plan, our plan is really separated in a phased approach. And a phase one is the phase that I'm going to talk about most here, because that is represents the conservation phase. That is the population. When the population is low, synonymous with listing status in Oregon, is phase one. And it's called the conservation phase. The objective for that phase is four breeding pairs for three consecutive years. You might remember on the graph I showed just a minute ago that in 2013 we documented four breeding pairs in eastern Oregon. And the year before that, six. So that represented two consecutive years that objective was met. What that means and the significance of that is that in the year 2014, the current year we're in, could be the third. Right now we've documented reproduction in six packs, in including the South Cascades group of wolves, and we actually expect more. We have some evidence of reproduction and even some of the others. So it's clear that Oregon's wolves are reproducing. What that means is that with this objective reached in 2015, our plans, our wolf plan calls for wolves being considered for delisting. So really, once we start into 2015, that brings that into play, the process of delisting.
So how quickly will we know?
I'm sorry?
How quickly will we know?
Chair Denbro, counts aren't done specifically or in an exact time because these wolves are secretive and they're actually very difficult to count. We try to get as much information we can before December 31st, but we also acknowledge that some of these packs we still may get additional information even into the new year. Most of the time it's in December or January. There's been times we were still gathering information in February. Yep. Also, I might add, too, is the way the plan is written, and the map that you see on the screen here divides the state into two wolf zones, the eastern zone, which I referred to earlier, and then the western zone, and really the plan calls for maintaining, even if delisting occurs at the point at which it does, if there is not four breeding pairs in the western half of the state or in that western zone, protections would be maintained as if they were listed. That's the way the plan is currently written. I think it's important, too, to understand the legal status, not just from a state listing, state ESA, but also a federal ESA status. In 2011, wolves were had been listed federally as endangered. In 2011, that listing was lifted. Those protections were lifted in the eastern third, which is the dark brown eastern third of the state, which, of course, as you see there, is where most of the wolves in Oregon are. The remainder of the state remains federally listed. There is a current proposal with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to federally delist these wolves. Right now, we don't really have any indication when and if that will happen, but we're expecting a decision at some point. Wolves remains listed under Oregon ESA throughout our state. So talk just real briefly about how we do this, how we understand how many wolves we have. These are secretive carnivores. They're not always easily counted. And so we use a number of different tools, as you see here, starting with just simple public wolf reports. We receive hundreds of reports per year from members of the public, hunters in a field in the fall. That will give us information, and oftentimes that's very valuable information. We also conduct a variety of surveys, howling surveys, track surveys, trail cameras, which is sort of a continual monitoring process. As was asked earlier, collecting genetic samples as we find them, scats, hair, tissues from captured animal, provides us a tremendous knowledge of how wolves and genetics are moving around the state of Oregon. Right now we have just a couple over 50, I believe, wolves from Oregon genotyped from these various samples. So we're developing quite a database, and that's been very helpful. Certainly, however, the primary tool for all of this, when I drew the polygons on the map earlier of where these wolves are, most of that information comes from the collars that we're putting on this, just like this wolf here. These are radio collars fitted with GPS units, give us pretty precise data when they function correctly. Wolves are very hard on these collars. To date, we've collared 28 individual wolves in Oregon. We have 13 still on the air. There's a lot of failure in the collars. Some of these wolves disperse to other areas such as Idaho and Montana and Washington, or OR7 to the Cascades. And then others, of course, die. Mortality takes some of them as well. So far this year, we have applied 6 GPS collars to wolves in the state of Oregon, all in northeast Oregon. We also monitor various types of take, which just to list a few, vehicle collisions have taken some on the interstate more historically than recently. Also accidental and illegal take. Accidental take is what you see in this photo. That particular wolf was caught by a licensed trapper, did all the right things, called us, and we were able to successfully put a collar on that and subsequently got a lot of good information out of it. So there is some nice processes built into this. When these unfortunate things happen, we're able to still get good information. We also have lethally removed wolves in the state of Oregon, 2009 and 2011. A total of 4 wolves have been killed in Oregon. And then, of course, last year was the first year, 2013, that we documented parvovirus in wolves, in Oregon wolves. It's not uncommon, it's not unexpected, and it affects wolves just like it does unvaccinated domestic dogs. But that also has the effect of reducing the number of breeding pairs. Switch a little bit now to the not-so-fun part of this, and that's livestock depredation. When wolves eat livestock, one of the things that the department is charged with is investigating and making a determination of whether it was a wolf caused loss, whether it's a death or an injury. As you can see from this this graphic here, we've looked at a lot of dead things over the years, and some of those have turned out, about a third of those roughly, have turned out to be confirmed incidents of depredation. So far, just in last year alone, 13 of those were confirmed. To date, all of depredation of livestock so far in Oregon has been in northeast Oregon, in those 3 counties, Baker, Umatilla, and Wallowa County, and really primarily in Wallowa and Umatilla County, very little in Baker. Gives you an idea here of the types of losses that we see, and this, I might add, this is only losses. This is dead animals, dead livestock caused by wolves, confirmed. And I would caution, this does look a little bit trendy. It looks, and I think you have to be real careful with that. Wolves generally depredate in groups or bunches, especially with sheep. And so, for example, as you saw, see on 2009, you will see a very large graph. That's a couple of depredation incidences in which a lot of animals died. And that's not uncommon. There is a significant part of this, and that is also that depredation trends in Oregon really mirror other states as well. So we're not seeing things new. Depredation is expected when you have wolves, and sheep depredation in most all states that have wolves is higher than cattle or other livestock depredation. And so far this year, too, I believe we've had over 20 depredated sheep. So the numbers are not extraordinarily high. At the same time, as our wolf population increases, they certainly could increase. Lethal control is a part of wolf management in most all western states, in most all states that have wolves, including Oregon. And in 2013, our commission adopted new lethal take rules, and those were a product of a settlement from a lawsuit, a subsequent settlement, and also had some legislative portion of that settlement as well. And essentially, they really redefined the conditions in which the department can and will use lethal control with wolves. There's a lot of process involved with that. Things that you see, such as here, areas of known wolf activity. These are areas that we've developed, publicly disclosed. This is where wolves occur as a way to notify people. Areas of depredating wolves, we publicly disclose these. I would say, really, the new rule puts an emphasis on non-lethal methods to prevent or reduce depredation, and public transparency. Those are the two primary things that it does. It also ups the bar for number of depredations required before lethal control is an option, ups the bar from 2 depredations to 4 depredations within 6 months, any 6-month period. So that's a bit of a change as well. There's a number, it's a very complex rule, and there's a number of provisions to it. Not all depredations qualify toward this lethal control rule, but right now we do have one pack in the Umatilla County. The Umatilla River pack has 3 qualified depredations.
Rest just a moment. Representative.
Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Just a quick question. Do you track whether the depredation is on private property as opposed to public lands?
Chair Dembro, Representative Hovey, yes, we do. I don't have that on the top of my head, but I can say this very clearly, and that is almost all of the depredations have occurred on private land to date. I can think of, off the top of my head, 3 out of those 48.
We're on public lands?
Yeah. We're on private lands. Only the 3 were on public lands. All the rest were on private. So clearly most of the depredation. Some of that is related to the time of year that depredation is more prone to occur in the spring and in the fall, and even in the winter.
Mm-hmm. So you're not seeing as near as much in the rangelands at all then?
Chair Dembro, Representative Hovey, that's a very good question. The short answer is no, we're not. I might add, however, and that might be brought up a little bit later as well, but clearly on most public land, open range, dispersed livestock situations, certainly finding depredation is much more of a task than, say, when the cattle or sheep are in a confined area near a ranch house in the spring. So that there is some differences there to consider in that.
Thank you.
I might say one of the outcomes of this rule was an intensification of the amount of information and the speed at which we provide information on wolf management in Oregon. We use our wolf web page as our primary information dissemination tool, and that's by rule, actually. And so now we have a system where anytime things happen with wolves, it's posted almost immediately, most of the time same day or within a day or two. And what you can find here is virtually all of the information that I provided up on the screen is available to the public anytime we change it: updates, depredations, investigations, what we know about packs, things like that. So it's been quite a resource, not only for the public, but even our own wildlife managers within the state. Right now, I believe there are more than 3,000 people signed up to receive automatic updates on the general wolf page. And for this page that you're looking on this screen is the livestock-centric page. I think there's a little more than 1,800 people signed up to receive updates. So there's quite a lot of interest in people getting information when things happen with wolves in Oregon. The last thing I'll talk touch base on is just a project that has just started this year. Our wolf plan calls for research of wolves, trying to understand as wolves develop, the populations build within the state of Oregon, their impacts or interactions with other important species are very important to us. It's primarily prey species, deer and elk, which is wolf primary prey, as well as interactions with other large carnivores. And so this year we're just starting a project with OSU to start looking at impacts and influences of wolves, at a growing wolf population, primarily in northeast Oregon, on deer and elk, and also on cougars. Some of you may remember that cougars have an almost singular effect on elk populations, and so how wolves interact with cougars becomes very important in that equation as well. Right now, we're primarily focusing on radio collaring more wolves and cougars within the study area and looking at prey selection, especially in different packs of wolves where prey availability differs. So we're excited about this project. We really haven't been able to start this until now because we haven't had enough wolves. But now that we do, it's really a great opportunity to start looking from the beginning, when you have a developing population, how wolves interact and impact their environment. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Russ. And we only have about 10 minutes left for this subject, so yes.
I just have a couple of quick questions. Thank you very much. Appreciate that very much, Russ. And my question is, you talked about deer and elk, but I understand we got a bit of a moose herd coming in as well. Have you done any studies on the Shiras moose in northeast Oregon?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Hansel, thank you for the question. We really haven't done any specific research type studies, but as you know, we do monitor moose, a small and growing moose population in northeast Oregon. I can't provide specific data, and but it is interesting that one of the packs, Oregon's longest standing wolf pack, is literally right in the heart of where the moose are numbers are building, and that is the Winnaha unit. We have had radio collared moose throughout the years, and we've actually documented very little, fairly high calf numbers to date, and very little mortality. We've yet to find a moose mortality. Without question, however, in other parts of the continent where wolves and moose are in the same area, wolves can have an impact on them. So it's just still undetermined here.
And one last question, if I may. On the Starkey report, we're looking at predation and whatnot. I'm assuming that we've got data on cougars. If you bring the wolves into that, that would most likely be additive as far as the predation is concerned.
Chair Denbrough, Senator Hansel, that really is the very heart of the question of the research. Is it as additive? We know that cougars and wolves interact. Most dogs and cats generally don't like each other, and there's a certain amount of data out there that shows cougar populations may change or even decrease as wolves increase in an area. And so really that's the question: is it really more predatory mouths being fed, or is there some compensation because of a potential change in cougar populations? We have one of the largest cougar data sets right now based on, we're just coming off the tail end of research that has occurred over the last 5 years. With that data set in the very area that we're seeing two new packs of wolves, it really is an opportune time to see, to measure that very question.
Okay, great. Gentlemen, we're going to have to move on to hear from the cattlemen in Oregon Wild. So thank you very much for your testimony. So if we could have Rob Clavins and Todd Nash, Tom Berkmeyer.
Tom won't be attending today.
Okay, great. Thank you. Tell him thank you. He saved us some time. But if you'll cover for him, Todd.
Okay.
You want to start off?
Sure.
Great.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Todd Nash. I'm the Oregon Cattlemen Association Wolf Committee Chairman. This is a kind of a conflicted subject in wanting more wolves in order to move on to a different phase in the Oregon Wolf Plan. The fact is that most cattlemen I know and represent didn't want them here to begin with. And so this is a major compromise for a group of people that work very hard to try to maintain what they have. And in representing this, it is the second largest commodity item that we have in the state of Oregon. Cattle are. Only nursery stock exceeds us. And I think this year, when the reports come back, we'll see that cattle will probably overtake that. In May of 2011, May 1st, I had a calf that was killed, and it triggered a point at which there was enough depredations at that point. U.S. Fish and Wildlife, who had jurisdiction over wolves at that time, they were federally listed, decided to take out two wolves. And it was turned over to ODF&W on the 5th of May, and they went ahead and went through with that. We were assured at that time that a chronic depredating pack, the Omnaha pack, would be taken care of, if not completely incrementally to the point where they wouldn't be an issue anymore. We went through that summer, and we had one more incident, and no more wolves were taken out. September 22nd of that fall, that year in 2011, I also had another calf taken out, and it triggered events at that time took place. There was an order put out to kill OR4, the alpha male, the Omnaha pack, and one other wolf. And at that time, there was only five wolves left in the Omnaha pack. OR7 had dispersed by that time, and several others. Shortly thereafter, on October 5th, ironically, I had another one killed on that day and confirmed. And there was an injunction filed by some of the conservation groups. And we saw throughout 2011, if you'll remember back to Russ's graph there in 2011, there was a spike in the number of cattle that were confirmed and killed. And it was a living nightmare for a lot of us that just saw cow after cow after cow killed, all from one pack. We were helpless to do anything about it other than non-lethals that were largely ineffective. We saw the frustration of an agency who wasn't able to do anything. We saw the slowness of a judge who sat on it and didn't get it before him. Anyway, it wasn't until June of 2013 that there was a settlement, and the settlement put us in a position where we have not got to a threshold again to where we've had lethal control on wolves. And we have had issues, and it hasn't been as bad in some of the private grounds, especially with the Omnaha pack. We've been effective in moving them out of some of those areas. But as Russ alluded to, we've moved them into areas where there's large timber allotments. One of the allotments last year put in a claim for 24 head of cattle, just one of them. There was another one that was 8 head short, another one that was 6 head short. And some of those had traditionally been 100% gatherer close to it. And so it's a large number of cattle. We did not change the behavior of those wolves. We changed the location and what they were doing. And we don't find those cattle in those large allotments. They get cleaned up. One of the thresholds for delisting wolves in the state of Oregon is that within the state, we can maintain our own wolf pack. And the Omnaha pack was the first one that good DNA was collected on, and we knew those were Idaho wolves. Excuse me, the Omnaha pack we know has DNA from the Omnaha pack, the Snake River from the Omnaha and the Walla Walla, the Minum pack from the Snake River, the Umatilla from Idaho, OR7 from the Omnaha pack, Mount Emily from the Walla Walla pack, the Chesnim wolves from the Walla Walla pack, and the wolves that were seen over in Baker that there was some scat collected on, we know were from the Imnaha pack. We are perpetuating our own wolves without the help of other states. In fact, we are dispersing wolves to other states, and we have data on that. As six wolves have thus far been collared in the state of Oregon and have left and dispersed as far as Montana and five of them to Idaho. So I address you here today, and one of the things that we've learned, and we learned the hard way, was that the rules within the Oregon Wolf Plan need to be backed up in law. And we're hoping at some point to be able to back up some of the legislation that advances us to put better controls on these wolves, to be able to back that up in law, so that we don't get bogged down in another court case that keeps us from being effective. This has been a very frustrating time for us, and we appreciate your consideration in that.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from Rob, and then we'll have some questions.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rob Clavins. I'm a recent resident to Wallowa County, where my wife and I own and operate a bed and breakfast on a working farm, but I've obviously been invited here, and I'm speaking today in the role of my as the Northeast Oregon Field Coordinator for Oregon Wild. I apologize for not getting written testimony. My sister decided to have a baby today, so that sort of ruined my day. Well, actually, it was a great day, but it messed with my schedule a little. I guess in a state that values native wildlife, the purposeful elimination of wolves in the last century was an environmental tragedy, and the return represents for most people a tremendous conservation success story that is not yet complete. Polls continue to demonstrate that most Oregonians, rural and urban alike, value native wildlife and want to see meaningful wolf recovery. As recently as last year, a poll showed Oregonians in favor of wolf recovery by a margin of 3-1, and even in Wallowa County, a poll showed that the desire to eliminate wolves has been a minority position. For the last 5 years, Oregon Wild, we've led an annual wolf trip to the county. We've had participants from as close as a few miles down the road to as far away as Portland, Maine, and Chicago. I can tell you that visitors to our bed and breakfast, some of them come for the abundant wildlife and just for the chance to hear or see a wolf. They take photographs, and they leave money at small businesses all around the county. It's important, I think, to remember that Oregon's wildlife belong to everyone, not just those of us here that are lucky enough to live in a place like Wallowa County. Oregon's vibrant tourism is in part based on its green reputation, the tremendous landscapes and the healthy wildlife that we have. In studies commissioned by Wallowa County, tourism stands alongside value-added agriculture as one of the most dependable growth opportunities. And it's important to note, I think, also that wolves play an increasingly, we're starting to understand, a critical and irreplaceable role in maintaining a healthy landscape. Just down the road at OSU, some of the world's foremost scientists are showing that effect, and I would welcome you to invite them one of these days to these hearings. I think it's an important perspective to consider. We have a plan that we've heard is not perfect, but I would argue it's generally working well. It's provided clarity. It's reduced conflict. It's increased public transparency. And though it adds some process before wolves can be killed, it provides certainty for the state and for stakeholders. We spent hundreds of hours and 17 months in negotiations with ODFW, with the governor's office, with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and we came to an agreement on the current plan. The livestock industry had strong representation. Chair Levy, who I believe was on the agenda as a spokesperson for the sheep growers, also serves as the chair of the ODFW commission that signed off on that plan before it was ratified by this legislature not that long ago. It's important to know also that the conservation community made significant compromises and concessions. Again, no one thinks the plan is perfect and we have serious concerns about it, but responsible actors are standing up to our obligations, and we don't think it's wise for anyone to blow up the plan because they didn't get everything they wanted. Entertaining one-sided proposals would only serve to send us all back into our trenches, and that's why I'm not here today to propose any, and I'm glad I haven't heard any. In addition to the compromised wolf plan, this legislature has provided a compensation program for those who lose livestock to wolves. You've provided tax credits for livestock operators, funds for removing carcasses and other basic non-lethal measures, and even provided recently more allowances for killing wolves. So again, there are problems with the plans, but there's also a process for addressing them that Russ brought up a little while ago. In less than a month, ODFW will be discussing the coming mandated five-year review of the Wolf Plan. It's a public process that allows tweaks to the plan, and everyone is going to have an opportunity to make sure that their concerns are heard. I also do want to flag that it should be noted that killing wolves does not always solve the problem that it purports to solve. Much like itching a mosquito bite, killing wolves seems simple and satisfying, but it often only makes the problem worse. In 2012, when Oregon was the only state with a meaningful wolf population that did not kill wolves, not surprisingly, the population of wolves went up, but the number of depredations decreased. Meanwhile, in Idaho, we had aggressive wolf management. We saw the wolf population go down and depredations go up. I wouldn't make too much out of one data point, but I think it's certainly something to pay attention to. And all of this takes place in the context of a population of 64 known wolves. And as it is, the plan allows the state and it allows citizens to kill wolves, but it prioritizes conservation. When the population is more resilient, we can have a different conversation. And as we heard here today, the wolf plan adapts as the population grows. So the wolf recovery is on track. It's worth noting that poaching continues to take place, parvovirus has shown up, and we have a cautionary tale in the Southwest that aggressive killing of wolves at this early stage can prevent meaningful recovery and only serves to prolong conflict. So I'd argue we can give in to old prejudices or we can try something better, and I doubt that 50 years from now our grandchildren are going to wish that we'd killed more native wildlife. The bottom line, and I'll wrap it up, is that some will never accept any restrictions on killing wolves, but killing does not make the conflict go away. The state has a compromised plan that this legislature, the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, conservation groups, ODFW, and the governor signed off on just a few months ago. No one thinks it's perfect. It allows an endangered species to be killed, but it also strives to balance science and Oregon's conservation values against a desire for active management and legitimate concerns. We have an established and transparent public process to fix it that's going to get underway in just a few months, and everyone gets a voice. So I appreciate the committee listening to testimony today, but would urge the legislature to not engage in any unnecessary distractions on this issue once the session starts. And I appreciate the opportunity to share the perspective from the conservation community.
Okay, thank you very much, Rob. And let me say first off, I should have said at the beginning that, you know, the conservation plan was, as you mentioned, it took many, many hours and hard work by Senator Hansel and my predecessor, who I heard a lot about those talks as we were driving down here together, and the trip she took out to Eastern Oregon was a real model. And, you know, so I just want to acknowledge that. Questions of the two gentlemen, or Todd, did you have any response to what Rob just had to say?
Senator Dembro, no. If there's any further questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Great. Yes, Senator Bates.
This question is for you, Todd. I'm kind of conflicted to this myself. My grandfather, I used to fly fish in the Minnehaha Basin all the time. I love that place. And I used to raise cattle myself, but I got a place for wolves here too. So I'm going both ways on you. The real question I have is, how hard is it for you to get compensation? You know, you run a bunch of cattle up in heavily wooded areas. You're not, you know, you usually pick up 100% of them, maybe one missing out of 100, and now you're dropping it down to, you know, to 80 or 85. There's no way to prove those were taken out by wolves, but it's likely that that's what happened. How hard is it to get compensation for that or for the known kills? I mean, is it a real battle to go through it to get that money, or is it, yeah, that was like the deal, everyone cooperates and you get paid market value for the cattle? Well, what's the reality on the ground here?
Yeah. Senator Dembro, Senator Bates, there's a compensation committee that's set up in each county, and it consists of a county commissioner, two livestock producers, two wolf conservation activists, and I believe it's one business owner. And those records of turnout and what was received back and historical data, if available, all comes into play. And so those producers coming in before that panel have to disclose what they have as far as records and what they would expect coming back. So there is a level of trust that goes into that. Usually we factor in a percentage that we would expect to lose naturally, and so that's about it. But it isn't an exact science.
So just to follow up, does that seem to be working, would you say?
Yeah, there is a function in the lost cattle, but there's a loss there that isn't considered as well. And one of the losses is there's a decreased amount decreased conception rate. And so one cow that doesn't get bred up, the next year is producing a $1,500 calf at this point. And so it's very significant to lose one, especially a young cow. The other thing that takes place is the overall weight loss. And so if those cattle have been stressed all summer, if you lose 25 pounds a head on 100 cattle, it's 2,500 pounds at $2.50 a pound. I don't have a calculator on me, but it becomes a significant amount of money. All those things add up. There's added amount of stress on the individual producers. They're out there checking their cattle more. You know, there's a number of things that don't get tallied into that. When Oregon State and the University of Idaho did a study on what the impact of wolves on 365 days a year in with your cows is, and this was about 4 years ago when we looked at that, it was $265 a head. Today, that number would probably be doubled. And so, you know, 1,000 head outfit, and they did a study on that, it's $250,000. And today, it could be close to $500,000. And the portion of that that is actually lost cattle or confirmed dead cattle is actually fairly small.
I was just going to say, well, I first of all appreciate very much both of you gentlemen. You've come as far in the state of Oregon, I think, as you can come to Salem to testify for a few minutes here and express your views, and I appreciate that very much. One of the things, and I was curious to your response, that I heard the department say, and we saw the slides on it, and I think, Todd, you alluded to that in the beginning, too, you know, that the wolf population has grown to the point that, and it has been federally delisted in that part of Oregon, that maybe the plan is getting to the point where we could seriously look at implementing that particular part, at least we have that option. And I would be curious as to what both of your responses would be to that.
Yeah, I think definitely, you know, we were told at the beginning, when wolves first came to the county, that we were waiting for that day when we would have four breeding pairs for three consecutive years, we could delist wolves and then better manage them. And we fully expect to reach that threshold this year. And it's a conflict because we don't necessarily want more wolves, but we want to get to that point where we can manage them. And it makes a big difference to the producers themselves how they feel about wolves when they know that there is some controls out there and they have some control over the matters.
Yeah, and I think you know, the folks from ODFW might have a better be able to better inform exactly how that process works. But as I understand it, when a species is delisted, there are five criteria that they have to meet, and when they do hit the number which they're likely to hit this year, four breeding pairs for three consecutive years, there's a process that starts, and there's not a predetermined decision. We may end up disagreeing on which way that should go. But I think if the state can build a case that it is based on the best available science, that this is it should no longer be an endangered species. There's adequacy of regulatory mechanisms and all the boxes are checked. That's what the state calls for. You know, again, I think though it's a process, it's not a predetermined decision of what exactly will happen. But the plan, one of the things I think was quite smart about it was that it did adapt over time. I think that's a wise choice.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you both of you. Thanks those of you from the agency who gave us a very informative presentation on where we are today. Colleagues, members of the audience, we had one other topic on the agenda. We don't have time to get to it. We will come back to it in our December meeting, but it is on OLIS for you to take a look at, a very interesting presentation on the new statewide landslide information database based on LIDAR information. Our really smart people from Dogami have been working hard on this. This is an issue that we're all interested in, and so we will come back to it next time.
Thank you.
Yes. So with that, I'm going to close the meeting and see you in December.
Wouldn't your song about that? See you.